the Off the Ball Podcast Network.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
Very good morning to you. Welcome along to OTB AM. We're here with you every morning from 7:30 until 9:30. I hope you're enjoying your Thursday morning so far and that you're feeling it as we cruise towards a bank holiday weekend. An easy enough way for you to return home from your travels. A short week, Owen.
Yeah, a 3-day week, a 4-day week, a 5-day week. Tapering is what you call it. That's me being a high-performance athlete in a work environment.
Exactly. You know exactly what you're doing.
Exactly.
There was science. You knew that you were coming home after the quarterfinals, basically.
Completely, yeah.
That was the odds.
For sure. It's like when a GAA person's club season runs into the inter-county season. Had Ireland made a World Cup final, my return to form would have been hampered hugely. So happy for that. Didn't make it to Paddy's Day.
How do you feel your step up is going? You know, day one, you were a bit shell-shocked yesterday.
Mm-hmm. No, pretty good. Like, I mean, you return. So this is my first Champions League midweek in the new format. Yeah. Obviously missed the first couple of weeks of it. It's a bit of a marathon.
Early game and the late game.
Yeah.
You are quite behind the times.
I really am quite behind
the times. It feels like we've always had the early game and the late game.
Yeah, it probably does. And I was like, well, so World Cup last year, you had 3 games back to back to back. This is possible. But I think the gap was a bit longer, I want to say. I think there was 3 hours between kickoffs.
It's also a World Cup, so it's like stuff you're never going to see again. But
exactly.
This is run-of-the-mill European football midweek.
Yeah, and like by the midway stage of the second half of the Liverpool game, I'm like, God, this really is. Jet lag is starting to hit now and things like that. But it's doable. I'm looking at the next couple of weeks. I mean, the actual compelling nature of getting you motivated to watch a 5:55 kickoff wouldn't be as good as it was for, say, last night when Ajax against Chelsea is happening. So I guess it's a bit of a once-off. And then I presume for the knockout stages they're not going to do this. But, you know, first world problems and all that.
Yeah, I haven't checked out the kickoff times for the quarterfinals because they stagger them over about 5 weeks, 4 weeks. And you obviously came to us, Owen, as like a young GAA-obsessed journalist. You've now spent 7 weeks embedded with the rugby press corps. Are you now a rugby person?
I've always been a rugby man.
Right.
Always been a rugby
man. Are you going to join the Rugby Writers Association?
Oh, God, that's a big question.
Will they let you?
No, I doubt they'd let me.
Why not? You just did a World Cup. You've got a tour of duty. You'll always have Vietnam.
It's true. Do I start going to the RDS or Thomond on Friday nights instead of watching it at home?
Probably.
I probably do, actually, to be quite honest with you.
You'll go to Leinster, though, because that's what will happen. You'll get sucked into the media bubble of Dublin.
Yeah.
Forget your roots.
If it hasn't already happened. But you kind of just go out of spite, really, towards Leinster rugby. So I could start doing that. Like, to become a member of the Rugby Writers Association, I think you need to have a good appreciation of the club grassroots game.
And so you could join.
Provincial is as far as my knowledge probably reaches, to be quite honest with you.
There's a good piece from Rory O'Connor today where he says Faf de Klerk is one of the stars of the tournament at 5'7". You know, you could easily join one of those clubs and get a role as a scrum half.
I know I could. Like without question, obviously. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about an appreciation for the club game, being a spectator.
Right.
Like, this is the Rugby Writers Association you're talking about here, not the Rugby Players Association.
I know. Well, you're obviously not going to get into the Rugby Players Association because you're not professional. You know, I don't want to shatter any illusions that you might have or dreams, but
what position would you play? I'm clearly a scrum half. What position would you play?
Well, I would be like a rambunctious 7.
Okay. Well, what's a non-rambunctious 7? Like, is a rambunctious 7?
I'd be Sean O'Brien, basically.
Sean O'Brien.
Yeah.
Okay.
That would be my spirit animal.
Not Josh Van Der Fleer sort of 7.
No. He's too scrawny. Adrian Jankowski says, morning, Adrian. And Mark O'Callaghan says, the M50 is jammed. So there you go, a little bit of traffic news for you at 7:34 a.m. this morning. Let's move on. Peter O'Mahony was talking to the media after the Irish team landed back in Dublin Airport. It was embargoed until this morning, so you'll probably see some of it in your papers. But here he is talking about Ireland's Rugby World Cup exit.
You've had a few days to reflect. Have you had a chance to make sense of what went wrong on Saturday?
Look, I haven't got a chance to look back at it. Obviously, we didn't perform to where we need to be performing or where we want to be performing. So look, I can't say if I look back at the game, so I won't be. I don't have any comment to make on that.
Can I just ask, obviously, you know, the Irish team seen great success in the last round of defeat. Is this perhaps one of the defining moments for you because sometimes coming back from defeat is
Yeah, look, it's very important. We've always learned from our experiences, and you probably learn most from disappointment. I certainly hope that it's not a defining moment for my career. But look, we certainly all these experiences and moments in our careers are one we'll always look back on for reference for future success. Hopefully.
Just, I know you had a bad day on Saturday, is it worse to be injured and unable to partake in it, you know, a bad loss, or to, you know, play and be involved in a bad loss? 2:15 to 2:19.
Well, if it was just me, I'd rather be here injured than the boys have won. You know what I mean? So, but that's so. I don't know. It's a strange way to look at it. Do you know what I mean?
Just aware of Peter and Joe Schmidt's legacy. Obviously, 6.5 years in charge with yourselves at Ireland, but maybe a word on his success he's had with yourselves and maybe the impact he's had on the team.
Look, you know, we could be here for a while with this answer. Look, I think for me, he's changed the prospect and the outlook on rugby for young generations, which is probably the biggest thing you could say about any person's career. You know, there's kids in Ireland now who will be expecting to be successful, expecting to win trophies regularly, and there'll be a big, huge portion of that will be down to Joe's work and his contribution there at rugby. So, you know, not only has he changed, you know, the direction of my career and this team's career, but he's changed probably the careers of the guys who are in primary school and secondary school at the moment. So he's done incredible work.
Thanks, guys.
All right.
Right, short and sweet from Peter O'Mahony in the aftermath of their return home. Obviously, that was at Dublin Airport last night. Brian O'Driscoll joined us to talk about what happened at the weekend. Basically, we got into loads of different bits and pieces. The best thing for you to do really is to download the whole thing. It's available for downloading offtheball.com/podcasts or also on the Go Loud app. But I want to bring you this clip in particular because it's worth delving into a little bit. Here he is talking about the impact that Stuart Lancaster had on Leinster and by extension, what difference the Leinster players might have felt with regards to Lancaster's coaching style and that of Joe Schmidt. Have a look.
I wonder as well, and this is, you know, I've just been kind of thinking about it. I wonder with Stuart Lancaster coming in and his focus being very different to Joe's, did that upset the apple cart a little bit? Because he was very much about unstructured play rather than Joe's focus around set piece. And did that kind of cast a few doubts into the players' minds as to what way they needed to train and what they needed to focus on? And I wondered, did that dynamic change things a little bit?
And that's an interesting one, because you would have presumed that the IRFU would have helped with that appointment with the dynamics of province and country in mind.
Yeah, but you can't stop a coach's personal beliefs on how the game should be played. You know, we talk, you know, to all the Leinster players that you hear under Leo Cullen and Stuart Lancaster, everything is about unstructured chaos, and you know, the launch plays are used to get into that unstructured play, and that's the vast majority of the game. Whereas Joe's been very much a set piece orientated guy. You know, when you look at lineouts, nearly 50% of Ireland's scores, I think it's up in the high 40s, originate from lineouts. Whereas you look conversely at someone like the All Blacks, I think they score almost 40% of their tries from turnover balls. So, you know, teams were able to identify that was our source of success. So how do you do it? Will you nullify it by stopping you at source, at set piece?
Yeah, I wonder if there's some way of combining those two things.
I was literally just about to say, how different would things have turned out if Lancaster had been inserted to the Ireland setup rather than the Leinster setup? Like, how different a team would you now be looking at? There are obviously a couple of obstacles. The first one is just a practical one. There were people in those roles already. Like him as a defence coach, for example, him taking Andy Farrell's role or something like that wouldn't have worked out. He wouldn't be a great defence coach, I assume.
I think he'd probably be pretty good at anything.
He probably would be. But what we're talking about here, what we really praise him for is...
So what I mean is, though, why can't we be good at lineouts and also be good at an unstructured play?
Yeah, like,
that's
of course.
The philosophies shouldn't be incompatible. Like, you should be brilliant at scoring off first phase, and then you should also be like very happy when that breaks down because you've got the players to do it. And that's the issue here, that I think we have the players to play in a different style from what we're currently doing, and the style that we have been playing in hasn't been good enough over the last 6 years to get us past the quarterfinals of a World Cup. Twice. Yeah.
And like one thing that was blatantly obvious for people to see as well at the weekend was that on a set-piece level we got destroyed as well, that at least we didn't do the things that we do well, very, very well.
We didn't get destroyed in the game.
But in terms of our pack up against theirs, this was a kind of a view before the game that perhaps the Irish pack would not only be able to hold parity against the All Blacks, but actually be able to dominate them in certain areas when it came to set piece or when it came to...
Well, we did okay in the line-out, we did okay in the scrum.
Off our own line-out, we were okay. Off our own scrum.
We stole one of theirs as well. Like
There was no dominance in when it came to our forwards. And like to be fair, you're not going to have that against the All Blacks in any facet, but we needed that. We needed some dominance in that department to actually allow us to be in with a shot of winning this game, because the way we play... If the ball was in the hands of the backs, it was never going to be a win for Ireland. It was never going to, in hindsight, be a close game for Ireland if it became a backs-based game. And that's ultimately what it became. But was that not what it became because New Zealand had their fair share of say up front? Like, they came away from the game thinking to themselves, we did pretty bloody well up front. Like, I mean, Ireland... Okay, held their own off their own line out, did okay
yeah,
off their own
sorry,
scrum.
Yeah, absolutely. In every other facet of the play, they smashed us. Like, their forwards won the game, their backs won the game. In every, there's no area other than I think we did okay from line out, we did okay from scrum. Like, we hit a level that was enough proficiency in both of those for us not to be beaten by 100 points.
Fair enough.
Should have been a much closer game on the basis of those. If they were the only things you were looking at, it should have been a much closer game. But, like, the handling errors were awful. The decision-making was terrible. The not being able to kick our penalties into touch, disaster.
But the point is that set-piece alone will never win you a game. Will never win you a game against a side of the quality of the All Blacks.
But I think maybe Joe Schmidt thinks that we beat them in Dublin by dominating set-piece and one bit of creative play, and all the rest of it was the quality of our defence. I think that's the whole point that Brian is making there, is that Schmidt believes that you can win games. Well, if 40-50% of your tries are coming off lineouts, you just need loads of lineouts because you're going to score a lot of tries. Like, that's how that philosophy manifests itself.
Yeah, for sure. And it doesn't help when Sexton misses touch when you're 10-0 down and you rely so heavily on your set piece. And like, I know that it's kind of a strange thing to get hung up on because of that. 6 inches to the left, it probably finds touch. Like, it was such a marginal call that you can't really say this was like a complete skills breakdown, but it is the most isolated incident we have of something that cost Ireland on the day, and cost Ireland hugely on the day in terms of exposing this massive gulf in class.
Yeah, alright, some of your comments about this. Josh Schmidt says, Gerard Tarleton, probably the best coach we ever had, and his team are the same. We just peaked in every way a year too early. The team weren't as good as it was. Sorry, the team wasn't as good as it used to be and was found out. Michael Monaghan, though, reckons that the failure falls squarely on the shoulders of the players. Stop. The fact of the matter is, regardless of what we did previously, these are professional players. This is their job. And they failed to get past the quarterfinals. They were our number one and they flopped. They're not number one anymore. They are all statement of fact. They are professional players. This is their job. They did fail to get past the quarterfinals. And they know they flopped as well. So, Aaron O'Neill, nobody does disappointment better than Peter O'Mahony. Being a Munster man probably gives him more practice, though. Ooh, the zings are coming. The next few months of civil war as we tear ourselves apart is going to be interesting.
Yeah, that's actually true. The hatred has, I guess, started. Josh Smith's been ticked off. The players have been ticked off. The box for the fans has been ticked off. The IRFU probably needs to, you know, the public anger needs to be directed towards them next, and then all of a sudden the players will get infected by this as well and start turning on one another. But hopefully on the pitch in inter-provincial games.
When do the Leinster fans start blaming the Munster fans, and the Munster fans start blaming the Leinster fans?
I would say that probably already happened.
Yeah.
It will kind of engulf on a massive level once the interpros actually kick off around Christmas.
Sean Rotafor says, Schmidt's achievements with Irish rugby should be remembered. Irish must continue to evolve, move on from quarterfinal loss, learn and plan for next Rugby World Cup. Do we have to even think about the next Rugby World Cup? I don't think anybody's ready to think about that just yet. New Zealand did this when France put us to the sword in two World Cups. Don't be too harsh on yourselves. As if I recall correctly, New Zealand were pretty harsh on themselves. Like, there was a period of national mourning. There was like questions in Parliament. There was proper multi-million dollar, New Zealand dollar investigation into what the hell happened. And ultimately it came down to, we choked, let's try not to choke.
Yeah, so is that, there's a lesson from that for us not to do that thing. Can we not just like bypass all the...
Just buy their report and go, that sounds feeling fairly familiar, don't choke.
Yeah, like, I mean, there's that. And then it's not just the All Blacks who take things especially seriously compared to Ireland. Like, I mean, after our Japan defeat, famously 4 years previously, there was a national apology made by South African coaches after they got beaten by Japan as well. So they obviously just take things a bit more serious on that level. And maybe we're still just getting used to kind of rubbing shoulders with the elite. Maybe it actually takes a few years for the impact of actually beating the All Blacks to seep on down into a cultural level. Maybe beating the All Blacks was seen as the achievement that it was at the time, which is something that no Irish team had done before. And maybe it's just not possible to make that next leap, which is actually cementing yourself as the truly best team in the world within that one cycle. As Peter O'Mahony said, maybe the legacy of that is kids watching at home seeing Ireland beat the All Blacks and thinking to themselves, well, actually, we're good enough and everything we do throughout our career is based on that. Whereas there's a lot of guys who beat the All Blacks at the end of their career and maybe there just isn't enough belief all the way through the career. Like, I mean, that's it's such a nebulous thing to be talking about. It's like very, very intangible.
Yeah.
But
could also be called clutching at straws, but
yeah, completely. And maybe it's a very much a
right
kind of a small country mindset as well.
Last comment for now. Alan Caffrey says he's changed the outlook on rugby for young generations. Irish football desperately needs a person like this. We definitely need somebody in Irish football to come in and change our outlook away from the negativity that is surrounding football at the moment. So let's move on. Here's what's coming up on the show. Sports page is coming your way. I'm going to talk GAA at around about 8:05. Mickey Quinn of Longford and Kieran Donnelly are going to join us to talk to us about the advanced mark and the Tier 2 competitions that are imminent. 2020 is going to see the first of them. I'm going to talk with Graham Hunter around about 8:30 this morning about the week's European football. We'll also talk about the real Ronaldo with him. Sports is coming your way at 9:05. And Phil's picks at 9:15. I just want to mention this. It's Childline Breakfast Week this week, and the ISPCC Childline is calling on clubs, schools, colleges and communities across Ireland to help keep Childline listening by hosting a breakfast this Childline Breakfast Week. Breakfast events are taking place across the country, raising vital funds to ensure children can always access support from Childline at any time of the day or night. Childline relies on this public support for over 90% of its funding, so all support is hugely appreciated. Childline can be reached by calling 1 800 66 66 66, or you can chat online at childline.ie. And any clubs or individuals who would like to host a breakfast for Childline Breakfast Week can still sign up at the ispcc.ie. Right, let's bring in the newspapers here. I'm going to start with the Sun. Back page of the Sun is slammed. They've put a picture in. Cop condemn own fans after obscene racist banner mars four goal super show. So obviously a routine enough victory for Liverpool against Genk. Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain back at the centre of things. But Liverpool have slammed their fans for unveiling an obscene racist banner depicting Cop star Divock Origi. And then Brian Lowen, it looks like, is going to get the job as the Clare Hurling manager after Louis Mulqueen last night withdrew from the race, leaving Lowen as the only remaining candidate. And it looks like Darren Randolph is in doubt for our European qualifier against Denmark next month.
They lead with GEA on the back page of the Irish Independent. Horrific decision taken by out-of-touch delegates. So this is Carla Boss Turlock O'Brien hitting out a Congress ruling insisting players won't take to Tier 2. Mooney willing to beg Kerr to return after extraordinary spat over email. Meanwhile, so Noel Mooney was speaking at a book launch at Abbottstown yesterday, and it seems that the launch of the book has been overshadowed somewhat because Noel Mooney was there. And naturally, you're going to ask Noel Mooney about the FAI, and he says, "We would love Brian Kerr to be involved in Irish football. He's a treasure to Irish football. He's achieved so much." He talks about Brian Kerr perhaps bringing emails into the public and talking about some of the correspondence between the FAI. Mooney says, "I have zero agendas. I just want Brian to come back in and have a cup of coffee. What it turned into then was extraordinary. I'm disappointed that he is not involved in Irish football. Like, short of getting on my knees, begging him to come in. I'll beg him if he wants to get involved. I'd be very happy to do that. I'll beg him. I'll ring him. I would email him again and again. But I sent a long note and he decided it was more important to use that in the media story to bash me than to bash the FAI." So strong stuff this morning from Mooney. And then you also have that story. Lohan set for a banner job as Mulqueen steps out of the race. Brian Lohan.
The Herald back page Poole's banner anger. So this is obviously overshadowing the game last night. We're not racists, is the other banner that they have at the bottom down there. Reds condemn Origi poster as Ox blast back with brace. And Solskjaer backs UEFA to do job in Belgrade. Man United will trust UEFA to implement the governing body's three-step protocol in case there are any outbursts of racism during their Europa League match at Partizan Belgrade this evening. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer said so. They're not going to walk off the pitch. They're going to allow UEFA to take charge of the situation.
Back page of the Mirror this morning is Screamers. Lampard says, it's scary how good my kids are going to be. Oxlade-Chamberlain wonder goal keeps Klopp's champions on course for Euro knockout. You've also got exclusive extracts from Owen Larkin's autobiography. He says, mental strength gave us edge over tip. How Colin Fennelly got it all wrong. And the night Tommy Welsh kicked me in the head of training. And Noel Mooney, I care about game and I want Brian back.
I presume he's talking about Colin Fennelly when he was sitting in that very seat you're sitting right now. Last year when he was talking about...
Of course, fellow army man.
Yeah. So, the Guardian, the back page of the Guardian is crash, bang, goal, which is a much bigger story, I think, really, from European football last night. Batshuayi's thumping late striker and Chelsea a notable Champions League triumph. They beat Ajax 1-0 with a goal after 86 minutes. If Frank Lampard can turn Batshuayi into a fully functioning, worth it centre-forward, he's got a future in the game. He's going to go a long way.
Yeah, like, I mean, he's not exactly polishing a turd there. Like, he's a good player. Maybe as a top-class Champions League footballer.
Vastly underachieving, though, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Like, and if my point is, if he can get value for what they've invested already in it, then that would be a pretty good sign. And then here's the other story. With the Telegraph says it's a shock, so we'll get to the headline next. England set to restore Ford and Farrell access for All Blacks. But I don't think they even dropped Ford at the weekend. They just decided this is how we're going to win this game. And this is how we're going to win the next game. And it's like, that's how you win over the course of a competition, is you pick different teams depending on what the challenge is.
Yeah, completely. I'm not surprised to see that story. Like, he played in the second half and was okay as well. So, not surprised to see him back in. Back page of the Irish Daily Star this morning is Ox Office. Alex's joy at leading way in Reds' route in Belgium. I think almost 3 years now since he scored a double in a game. Mooney says, I'll beg Kerr to return. And Lohan has Clare edge. Meanwhile, step in the right direction for Keogh. So watching on Derby's Ireland star Richard Keogh, who was injured in a car crash recently and will miss the rest of the season at the Rams game at Wigan at Pride Park last night.
Telegraph, England planning shock forward recall. But it's not really that much of a shock. I think they're trying to bump it up all right. And then Blues here, that's a picture of Batshuayi celebrating after they beat Ajax. David Dilling was very interesting in the studio yesterday, saying he's really looking forward to that game to see how much progress Frank Lampard had made. So must be pretty happy with how they actually performed last night.
Yeah, and then kind of you can single out the performance of Christian Pulisic, who's struggled at the start of his Chelsea career, coming on and playing really well yesterday. Back page of the Irish Daily Mail is Lohan's run. Mulqueen drops out as banner hero, takes reins. And it was easy to choose Ireland, says McIlroy. So this is ultimately an easy call for him, deciding to stand under the Irish flag at the Tokyo Olympics next summer. And Clive Woodward says Owen Farrell is the Roy Keane of English rugby. The comparisons seem to begin and end at the fact that Farrell can be a bit moody before games.
We'll come back to that a little bit later. Lohan's run is a cultural reference. It's a bit out of date.
Very out of date. Because it has sailed about 20 metres over my head.
There was a 1976 science fiction film called Logan's Run.
Right, okay. Any good?
Don't know, haven't seen it. In the year 2274, young residents enjoy an idyllic hedonistic lifestyle, Owen. A bit like you in Tokyo.
Oh, full hedonist.
Within the protective confines of a domed city. The general belief is that when each person turns 30, they're reincarnated for another blissful life cycle. Those who know the much darker truth become runners and flee to a hidden sanctuary.
What happens when your life recycles? And
I presume you get killed.
Do you like start at zero again, or do you go back to like being 19, 20, and you just get to love your life for the rest of your life?
Yeah. So sounds like it could be good.
Great premise.
70s, best era for movies. Right, Sports Thursday in the Irish Times. Oxlade-Chamberlain's double flourish eases Liverpool to win. Chelsea leave it late as Batshuayi hits winner. And United prepared for worst case of racial abuse scenario. That's the headline over the piece of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's press conference yesterday. And then backing All-Ireland League should be a no-brainer for Irish clubs. Big meeting in Dundalk tonight where The proposal will be put to a bunch of clubs from both sides. This is Kieran Lucid's proposal for an All-Ireland League. Rangers need to make Mark O'Neill. Cross and Glen expect a real battle as they take on Monaghan winners Clontibret. So Ulster Club Championship gets underway in earnest this weekend. It's going to be pretty interesting to see exactly how far this Cross and Glen team can go, because they're not the same team, obviously. That was the dominant and greatest team of all time in club football. But, you know, it's still there in the DNA, still there in the bones somewhere.
For sure. Back page of the Times, the London Times. A super sub Batshuayi stuns Ajax. Ford set for a recall to face New Zealand. And Cardiff failed to protect young stars. So Cardiff City admitting to the existence of an unacceptable coaching environment at their academy after an investigation into allegations of bullying. A statement was issued last night. Cardiff didn't name anyone, but referred to accusations against current and former employees, conceding that there was a lack of effective safeguarding processes. Cardiff said they regret the impact this has had.
The Examiner, very quickly, is cool cool by the pool, and they also have spoken to Albie Mathieson and Arno Botha, having their say, and obviously Munster's Kiwi and Springbok, and they also have Unai Emery ahead of the game tonight, with Rory McIlroy talking about playing in the Olympics for Ireland as well.
Racing Post, Ruby Walsh saying that we must stop the fiasco of races going off at the same time in British and Irish racecourses. And back page of Racing Post is boys are up to the challenge. It's Celtic against Lazio, 8 o'clock kickoff tonight in the Europa League.
Got the Irish news for you as well, finally, for now. Deegan, Mechanic Cup move pays lip service to player welfare. This is a story about Conor Deegan. Talking about the Mechanic Cup and Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain at the double. Obviously, return to form that Liverpool fans have been waiting to see for a while, but very happy, no doubt. Now, all this week on OTBAM, we've been giving you the chance to win UEFA Champions League quarter-final tickets with thanks to Pepsi Max, one of the proud sponsors of the UEFA Champions League. To be in with the chance of winning this morning, share the show wherever you're watching or listening and send us your first Champions League memory. Remember, if you don't win on OTBAM this morning, then there are loads more ways for you to win. With 20 tickets up for grabs for games in the Champions League group stages, check out pepsimax.ie for more details there. Pepsi Max, maximum taste, no sugar. Moyles has been in touch, Anthony Moyles, this morning. Where was the Irish mindset, lads? They looked meek, shocked even. Surely they would have been prepared to at least have their heads right. Be up for it. Show fight, passion. And then it's the see no evil.
You would have thought so. You definitely would have thought so. It's like, you would, if they had somehow managed to turn the tables and do the impossible last week, you would have been looking at the scenes before the game and that emotion, saying that's a sign of strength and that's a sign of them willing to show everything that they had deep within their soul. And now it's like, God, look at them. They didn't even have the bottle to hold the tears in. So it's, no matter what way it would have happened, it would have been criticised, I reckon.
It's 7.58 this morning. You're watching an OTBAM, the Sports Breakfast Show from Off the Ball. We're coming back to some of the sports pages a little bit later on. But up next, we're getting to the changes in the GAA for 2020 next, with Kieran Donaghy and Longford's Mickey Quinn. Back in a moment. OTB AM. All right, you're very welcome back. Let's talk Gaelic football. I'm delighted to say we've got Mickey Quinn of Longford and Kieran Donaghy on the show this morning to talk to us about what happened at the weekend in terms of the advanced mark and also Tier 2. We might start with the advanced mark first. Kieran, are you a fan of this?
I am. I'm a fan of it because anything that promotes kicking the ball in quicker and earlier and more 50-50 battles in around the scoring zone, I think is a positive for me. You know, there is the slight negative of, you know, are a lot of our young players who become very good at the mark at underage level, are they going to be picked up and poached by Australia? But I think the best young players are being taken, you know, over there anyway. So I think to promote kind of accurate kicking inside, early ball inside, this is a good way. And, you know, It'll force every fella to go away and work on taking frees, because I found that out in Australia with the Aussie rules when I was winning ball inside. Taking a kick, a free kick when you're not used to it, takes a bit of getting used to, and they'll have to go working that skill set.
Are you tempted to make a comeback now, you know?
No. No, look, for Kerry's point of view and, you know, a player like Tommy Walsh, who proved, you know, very hard to mark in the league, with the mark, it proves that, you know, from what he learned out in Australia with leading out in front of his men and the timing of that and the execution of it, he could prove very useful for Kerry next summer with this ruling.
This is different though from the league here, isn't it? It's 45 meters in, and as long as it's a 20 meter kick, like I thought the one in the league was very effective as well. I thought it really added to the game, but 45 meters out from goal seems a bit much, does it?
You have to win it inside the 45, yeah?
Yeah, you've got to win it inside the 45, but in the league it was you had to win it inside the 20 in the 20 meter line.
I don't think so.
No?
No, I don't think so. I thought fellas could win it outside the
20. That's my bad. That's my bad. Sorry. I just have visions of balls being kicked in and you had to be in and around the scoring zone and inside the 45.
No.
Apologies, yeah, Kieran.
You're okay. No, inside the 45, yeah, because you know some teams are very good at it in the league. You know, and fellas are going to have to work on their kicking and their accuracy, and kicking it to a guy on the full is going to become important now. And, you know, you can still bounce it in. If you bounce a ball into an inside guy, you know he's going to take his man on and it's going to be like normal. But
yeah,
if you can execute that ball in, you know, you're going to get that opportunity to put the ball over the bar, and, you know, it should promote more scoring. And there's no harm if a high ball goes in. And if a guy catches it and his body positions in the right manner, he'll be able to turn and take on his men for a goal like normal. I don't think everybody's just going to catch a ball and stop. But what it does allow for is that 50-50 contest where, you know, the excitement of that ball going in and someone going up fetching it, and they don't have to worry about landing and getting bundled up by three or four players and getting these annoying turnovers that we see in the game constantly, where an inside forward wins a great ball and he's bottled up by three or four guys and he's trying to get out of it and the ref calls him for over-carrying. So that's, you know, I think that excitement of that big ball in, you know, is something to look forward to with it.
Yeah. Mickey, you obviously have experience of playing Aussie rules and also playing in the league last year. So what's your take on how this rule is going to impact the future of the game, knowing as you do how the game was played in Australia?
Yeah, I suppose probably for ourselves, the first two or three games that we played was the Auburn Cup, and there wasn't one mark taken in those games. And I think the thing with it, it's going to be seasonal. You know, at the start of the league in poor conditions, you're not going to see too many of those marks taken. But you're only going to really see what Kieran's talking about when you get to the good stage on a good pitch playing in, on a summer's day, where you can actually go after those marks and manage your game for those kind of marks. The worrying thing probably would be game situation-wise. 4 points down, 5 minutes ago, it might promote teams to drop back and flood the defence. And then, you know, I think 15 seconds once a mark is taken inside, is that too long? That was one of the issues that was raised, which will kind of slow the game down a good bit. So I think it's going to take a little bit of time. There might be a little bit of tweaking to be done with it, but I do think it could be a positive thing to promote guys launching at the ball and going for those marks. And I suppose from a referee's point of view, that they allow for that, that there will be collisions in the air, there will be walls breaking, and it will be slightly messy, but you kind of have to roll with that if that's the approach you're going with.
Yeah, okay. Tommy Rooney was talking to an intercounty forward last night, just kind of ringing around to see exactly what people thought about this. And he said, this is somebody who had actually taken three or four marks during the league this year, that had actually slowed the game down instead of speeding it up. His instinct was to play a fast game, but ultimately the mark adds to the slow play and kills the tempo of the game a little bit, Mickey.
Yeah, definitely. I think the thing with hand ups to signify that you're going to take the mark, it's not natural for Gaelic football, and that's going to take a bit of time. You know, if a guy comes out, wins the ball on the full at pace, and he's turned and he thinks there's an opportunity, well, the defender isn't going to step off him and say, right, off you go, you can play on, or he's taking his mark. And then our referee is going to penalise the defender for stopping him and bring the ball in another 10, 15 metres as a result of stopping him or impeding him from playing on or taking the mark. So there's kind of a few little grey areas that it's just going to take a little bit of time to get right.
Yeah, it's going to be very demanding for the referees as well, Kieran in particular, exactly the distance, the 20 metres, so the ball has travelled in the air, and then, as Mickey rightly points out, was it an intentional? Did you come down together at the same time? Did you try and play on? Were you trying to take your mark, but actually pretending to play on. There's a lot of areas where the referees are going to have to go, okay, I need to understand exactly how this works in practice.
Yeah, there is, of course, and it will take a bit of getting used to. But, like, you know, Mickey's point there about teams being 4 or 5 points up and they're getting everybody behind the ball to stop the mark. Teams are doing that anyway. You know, when teams go 4 or 5 points up now, it's very much teams are excellent at killing off the game. And I think, whereas, you know, they get bodies back. So when you do win a ball late on in the game, as Mickey said, they're 4 points down with 5 minutes to go. If you win a ball in around the scoring zone in them stages, you're bottled up by all these defenders back. Whereas now, if you can figure out a way to win a ball, you know, you get to win that mark. And 15 seconds, is that too long? I don't know, Mickey, you know from Aussie rules, but they get nearly 30 seconds in Aussie rules, if not longer, to take a kick. So I wouldn't be overly worried about the speed of the game being impacted. I think what players will get used to is when they're going for the ball, for them to know in the process of going for the leap, you know, what's on here? Is there a goal on? Am I one-on-one? Is there bodies around me? And they play it accordingly to that. So if there's loads of bodies around and there's a big ball coming in towards me, I know all I have to do is get my two hands in it and land on the ground with the ball in my hand and I'm going to have a point. So I think it does promote that. The referees, they're going to have to, of course, they're going to have to take a bit of getting used to. You know, you see with that 13-meter rule on the kick all the time, you know, the short free kick, you see that always, fellas kick it 7 or 8 meters and it's play away. Refs never call it, they're never sticky with it. Whereas they will have to be with this 20 meters for the mark because it's going to result in scores. I think it'll improve the game. I'd be much more concerned about the sin bin than I would the mark.
I do wonder as well if there is kind of an unintended consequence here. Maybe it is very much an intended consequence. It's like when it comes to the flow of the game, seeing good kind of in front of your man defending perhaps might be more of an option. Would there be more of an ability to take a risk? Because now, after all, the greatest risk of all is actually allowing your man to catch the ball and actually getting out in front of him and breaking that ball is less of a risky move as a defender. And perhaps that'll add to the attraction of the game.
Yeah, I think so. And I think defenders are pretty good at, you know, knowing what stage of the game it is, how much pulling and dragging they can get away late on in the game, you know, spoiling that ball late on in the game. So that's the big ball in around the house. And it's not going to be that. You know, I think we have to be very aware of it. It's not going to be this big ball in around the house, in around the square all the time. It's going to be guys being smart enough to figure out how can I get it from 30 meters away from the ball, make a good run and get it into my chest. And then I have a free kick from maybe 30 yards, maybe 35 yards. But if guys work on those kicks and get used to that situation,
yeah,
you know, if you're 5 points down now with 8 or 9 minutes to go, I think it's going to make it easier. And I think you're going to have more option to get back into a game. If you win 3 of those 20 yard passes out in front, you bang them over the bar with 15 seconds and you're not surrounded by a load of bodies, you know, now all of a sudden a 5 point lead could become a 2 point lead. And maybe then you're able to go for that last big ball in around the house to see if you can get something.
Yeah. Mickey, again, just to, in terms of the experience of what it's actually like to play against and to defend somebody who's capable of taking marks, to Owen's point, are we going to see defenders playing a lot more in front of their man? Are we going to see more forwards making those runs out in certain specific corridors that are close enough to a shooting zone that they're going to be able to win a fairly routine catch? Under less pressure than it would be if it was a diagonal ball larried in on top of the big man on the full forward line?
Yeah, I do think it's going to change a lot of, like, the general play across the board and how you defend, how you attack, and what way you're going to go about things like this. As a defender, if you're in a position that you need to, you know, cut out, step in front and not allow for that mark, it's going to keep the defenders on their toes, and that's going to be difficult. You know, if there's a forward leading out on the full looking for that ball, and you're marking a big man, you might have to play in front. But it's going to be a change of defending that hasn't really been part of the Gaelic football game from a full forward side of things. I suppose Kieran probably would be an exception to the rule from that side of things, but. Probably the other thing with the slowing the game down with Mark, it's the kick out, the follow on kick out. You see it now at the moment, like the Dublin or Mayo, that if it's a scoreable 3 or 45, it's a perfect opportunity to set up a zonal defence. And that was one of the big things in the AFL.
if the team got a scorable a mark inside the 50, you know, you set up an 80-man zone and squeeze, and the only result from that was a long kick out down the line along the boundary and knock it out of play, and it was a result of another restart. So you have two or three restarts after one another, and it becomes a very stop-start game. Whereas if you look at what's great about the game at the moment is quick kick-outs, moving the ball quickly, and it's end-to-end stuff. And that could change the dynamic of the game massively.
Are you in favour of it?
I think I'm keen to try to see how it goes. I do think it needs a bit of time. I think there's a lot of positive, and it's a skill that's not really worked on. It's kind of, you know, midfielders out around the middle, but from the kick passing point of view, putting in those outside of the boot passes or floaters that are hanging up for guys to launch at it, it's massive from that side of things, and then the catch itself. So I think it's worth a try and see how it goes.
Yeah, it seemed, Kieran, like Dublin didn't engage with this in the league at all last year, that they knew that the championship was going to be refereed under the old rules, and it was such a big historic championship for them that they were going to stick with it. It'll be interesting to see how they adapt to this and whether or not their current playing pool is exactly the right playing pool you need for a completely different style of play.
Well, like, just on top of that, it seemed that in the summer they almost changed to more. The way they played in the summer was almost more advantageous with a mark than without it, which kind of seems unusual, like going route one towards Conor Callaghan a bit more. I don't know what you think here.
For players like Conor Callaghan, who's unbelievable at winning any type of ball, it's going to be lovely for him. It'll make his men not be able to mark him, you know, from in front as much, because he has that threat over the head. A guy like Dean Rock, it's absolutely perfect for Dean Rock. It's going to be, can we get the 20-yard passes to Dean Rock on the money anywhere inside the 45? He's going to plank that over the bar every time. So, you know, of course, there's going to, like, teams should be talking to people like Mickey and, you know, guys that have come back from Australia or get on to guys out in Australia to say, okay, guys, you know, how do we maximise our potential on this? And Mickey made a good point about, you know, the press and the kick out, you know, from guys taking these scorable frees when they got 15 seconds to take the free. You get to push everybody up the pitch. We saw Kerry do it this year. We saw Dublin do it. Mayo have done it in the past. You know, again, that's, I hate the short kick out to the cornerback. I think it slows up the game. You know, I think it turns it into a laborious game. They have to carry it all the way up the pitch. It allows the opposition to get loads of bodies back. At least this, you know, if more teams do go into the press, there's more 50-50 ball going out the middle. Teams are going to have to get better at fielding ball out there. It'll bring the fielder back. We saw a lot of teams, until the likes of Fenton and Dave Morn, a lot of teams weren't playing that big man in the middle of the pitch. It was all runners and guys that were athletic that could get up and down the pitch but didn't really have to contest much ball. So I think, you know, if there's a press on, there's a lot of kickouts going out, you know, teams are going to be able to try and win that ball out there. You win it out there against the press, you catch that clean against the press with the mark, you can turn and get your ball into your forwards early, and we'll see a bit more excitement in the game that way too.
Yeah, okay, let's move on. I want to talk about Tier 2. Mickey, what's your take on how we've ended up where we've ended up, where Division 3 and 4 teams who don't make the provincial final are going to be playing in a Tier 2 competition as opposed to for Sam Maguire?
Yeah, I suppose when this was talked about nearly 2-3 years, it was one of those things that was mentioned in Champions League style was talked about, and different formats, and it was exciting, and it was something that I was massively in favour of, that I think, you know, Longford could thrive off something like this and make massive improvements, and everyone wants to play more games, and you see different sides of the coin now, but 63% of squads that were surveyed were against the second tier championship that's after been brought in. It was 4-4 in Division 1, 3-5 against, 2-6 in Division 3, and 3-5 in Division 4 against as well. So, you know, it's players in Division 3 and 4 are affected the most, but at the end of the day, players want to play the most games, and from our route, we'd be hoping that to avoid that, in the sense that we can get promoted out of Division 3 this year. That's one option. Our other option is, you know, we get to a Leinster final, which that brings into play the whole provincial championships, how unbalanced it is at the moment and how you're relying on that. So if for the likes of ourselves, we could end up playing two games in the championship, or we could end up playing three or four in a Leinster and then into a second tier competition, and you could be lucky enough to get four there. So I think it's something that the likes of Longford and counties in round that standards, it's definitely a good thing for us. But what opened my eyes was it might not necessarily be for a Division 4 team or lower Division 3, Division 4 team, that, you know, their wants or needs aren't the exact same as ourselves. And that's where the difficulty comes, that it's not a one-size-fits-all. And it feels like it was rushed through.
Yeah, it does feel like it was rushed through, absolutely. Kieran, what's your take on this?
Firstly, look, as you well know, and we talked about it earlier in the year, I am, of course, in favour of a Tier 2 championship, but I'm not really, you know, I think this has been a rush job without enough information, on how the media are going to cover this. You know, how much airtime these Tier 2 teams are going to get. You know, it's just, you know, and I think if the players really, if they're not happy with it, they got to go and take some action and do something about it, because, you know, this needs a, and the championship needs an overhaul. You know, we said it earlier on in our review of the championship that the provincial championships in bad winter weather, where people don't subject them to traveling long distances. You get the provincial championships on in February and March. You make them round robin. You give everybody four or five games. You hand out the trophy at the end of March. Whoever wins their provincial championships, it's great. And then you go on your league basis of who's in Division 3 and Division 4 right now, who's in Division 1 and Division 2. You split them into pots and you let them try and play like a premiership and like a championship over in England, where the championship gets lots of airtime. There's some great games. They show live games. We all sit down and watch them. And obviously you've got your whoever gets into the semi-finals and finals of that Tier 2 gets promoted next year into the Sam Maguire. Whoever doesn't perform in Tier 1 that year, the bottom two teams in each group get relegated. And the excitement that brings, the promotion, the relegation, the desperation, the fans, you know, upsetting the stand. They're upset in the stand when they get relegated from the Premiership, but come 3 months' time, they're all rubbing their hands together saying, okay, let's win the championship now and let's get promoted back into the Premiership. So, you know, if teams aren't happy, they're going to have to take action, force the GA's hand into actually looking at this and doing it properly maybe next year, get proper details on what way the media are going to cover this. You know, that's the critical thing here is this 3 minutes in the Sunday game of these two Tier 2 games going to be enough? You know, how many live games are on, and I think John Horn has been right in what he's trying to do, and he knows that it needs to happen. But I think it's been pushed through to happen more so than to really concentrate and really get it right on how they go about kind of overhauling the whole championship as a whole, allowing time for your Sigerson Cup in December and January, playing your provincial championships, finishing your club All-Ireland before New Year's, all them type of things where there's clear windows of what's going on and what people can show.
Like, Kieran, if anybody wanted to take out the most meaningless part of the current football championship, the way it is, they'd probably take out the provincial championships. Like, I think to most people, from a neutral standpoint, they are the most pointless part of the calendar. They make no sense, particularly in Leinster. It's an absolutely pointless championship. The Munster Championship, to a point, is a pointless championship as well. Like, in the sense of a championship, as in the winner is as close to predetermined these days as it possibly can be. That is the point of a championship, determining who should win it. But because of this structure, the provincial championships are more powerful. Like, I often wonder if, like, this Tier 2 championship is just put up as this kind of main topic, but actually secretly behind it, this is one last ditch effort to save the provincial championships. Making your final now, it becomes more important, even though you might get drawn against Dublin in the first round. Like, I mean, that's completely unfair, like, on those counties, just because they're thrown in against Dublin. Whereas if you're a Limerick footballer, you might draw Waterford and Clare and you might get two small shocks, and then suddenly you're a Tier 1 county. It's based on geography, and it's complete nonsense that this is actually the case.
It is, yeah. I agree. And you know, like, but I don't agree with you in principle about the provincial championships. I think if they were played in February and March, and you know, Kerry had to go up to Ennis on a wet night in February with a big breeze, you know, all of a sudden Clare get the crowd behind them. You know, they could pull off a result there. In but if it's a round robin stage, it just means every team, you know, is getting that 3 or 4 games in their provincial championships. They get used to playing each other. They get used to figuring each other out. Maybe teams get a better chance to improve year on year by guaranteeing them games. But my issue with this tier two is you're still going to have teams that are going to lose, you know, a championship game in the summer. They're going to go into the tier two, they're going to lose, and they still end up with 2 games. And that, to me, is we're doing the teams an awful disservice down there. My big thing with the proposal we talked about on Shot Clock this year was the fact that a Division 4 team would get the chance to play 7 games during the summer months. They'd get the chance to really find out about themselves. They'd find a way to learn more about how they improve as a team, what they got to do better next year. How can you know what you got to do better next year when you lose 2 championship games and you're out? It's impossible for these teams to improve. They have no hope of winning the All-Ireland, but they do have a hope if they get things right and they work hard and they're organised and they use the rules to the best of their ability, they do have a chance to win or get into at least a semi-final of a Tier 2 championship, you know, where it's big games, you know, the final is played before the All-Ireland final. As I said before, we don't need minors, we don't need 16 and 17-year-olds playing on All-Ireland final day. It's too much pressure now with social media. You know, if some fella misses a kick or a free, he's getting stick in school the following day. They just don't need to be under that type of pressure. And I think it'd be much more of an atmosphere if you 2 tier 2 teams in an All-Ireland final. Of course, that'll go back to the head, the brasses, all these people that sit at Congress, and they go, oh, well, we won't be able to get all our tickets. We'll have to give more tickets out to the tier 2 teams. And that probably doesn't suit. But again, you know, it's old way of thinking. We got to figure out a way of to promote every team and to allow teams to really, during the summer months, for their fans of each county to get a bit of momentum up and travel and get around and see different places and try and get a bit of momentum that way. This, you know, as I said, John Horan is right in principle about wanting a tier two, but I think this has been, you know, and so overwhelmingly won in Congress, it'd make you ask, how does this go? What are the phone calls in the lead up to Congress? What type of pressure is applied on county boards, people that are there, delegates to get this over the line? But you know, it needed more thought. It needed to leave this year the way it was and really come in with a full restructure of our GAA games on football side of things. I think the hurling have it pretty well now at the moment. You know, there is massive stock in their tier two and tier three competitions. You know, I know from watching the Kerry lads and seeing how they progressed up the ranks, and you see Laois this year. Yeah. You know, you wouldn't have called them a tier one, but no, they are, because they fought their way into it. So that's what it should be about. You should be rewarded for having a good season.
Yeah. Kieran, we let you go. I know you got to go, but thanks a million for joining us this morning. That's great stuff as usual. Mickey, I did want to ask you one last thing, because a very high-powered committee, the Fixtures Review Committee, was put together to examine exactly how the fixtures should run for the future of Gaelic football. And they're going to report, I think, in the next month or so. Has all their work been wasted, given that we already now have this new competition that didn't exist before they started their review of what the problems were?
I think so. Whether something that their review or their report could have been pushed forward and rushed through to before Congress, that's another matter. But why set up a committee like that? To their sole task is to come up with solutions and reports and recommendations on something like this and not pay heed to it. So it just doesn't make sense. Whether there is alternative motives to get something like that rushed through, I don't know, but it just seems daft, really.
As a player in your dressing room, is everybody in agreement with you that this is broadly a good step? Like, are those conversations happening on a fairly regular basis? Do they not happen that much? Or what is the kind of level of engagement that you guys have collectively with this?
Yeah, definitely it could be better from a player's point of view. You know, the players probably have
sat back in a sense and probably might not have engaged as much as they should have. But you see it coming through that, you know, it's about player buy-in now. The different articles saying that, you know, it's up to the players to make something out of this. But if it was like that, then take on board what the players have been saying. 63% of squads not in favour of it. That's fairly black and white that, you know, this might not be the exact way to go and take that feedback on board. But I think only time is going to tell now. I was very wary that something like this would come in and it's going to be harder to reverse it than to try and get a more one-size-fits-all solution than try and rush through something that might not be as successful.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair enough.
The gap in the window, you know, let's say the likes of Longford were out in Leinster early. We lose that game, we're going to be sitting a long time waiting before a second-tier championship comes on board. And that's where the difficulty arises with players not committing then for the, you know, you're back in club mode there for whether it be 6 weeks or whatever, and then to try and get back in the horse and go again later on in, let's say, August, I think it is. So that's going to cause issues in itself.
Yeah, I can definitely see players deciding that they're not going to get involved if you're at the lower end of Division 4 or even the lower end of Division 3 and you don't really feel if the draw is bad, particularly in one of the Leinster counties where you've got no chance of making a provincial final. You can see players opting out after the league and going, right, well, we didn't get promoted this year to the top two divisions, so I'm taking the summer off and I'm going to go to the States and make some cash.
Yeah, and I suppose we were in that position last year with a few guys, and, you know, don't begrudge it, they're dead right. You know, and the league is a competition for ourselves that it's massively important, and it's even more important now with the Sam Maguire and the second-year competition. We're lucky enough this year with the draw, the Leinster draw, that we are on the opposite side, and it is something that we can see ourselves maybe giving it a right crack, and that might entice players. But, you know, in a year or two's time, when that might change and you've a tough first-round game, then those things are going to come to fruition.
Right, fair enough. Mickey, thanks a million for joining us this morning. Best of luck with the game against Garrycastle this weekend. I hope you guys make it through. This is really one of the best competitions that the GAA has, particularly at this stage where club champions come out and they start to face each other and everybody looks at what certain clubs have done at this stage of the competition in recent years and go, yeah, I can believe that we've got a chance here of a bit of glory.
Yeah, definitely. You see last year's, there's always shocks and upsets. You know, that's why people love it, and that's why people love sport, is the underdog story and the underdog winning games, and that's probably what you're hoping to see at an inter-county level, which you don't see as many nowadays, but the club championship is something that there's shocks on the card every week, so fingers crossed.
Well, best of luck to everybody from M&O Clough against Garrycastle this weekend. Mickey Quinn, very good with his time this morning. And Kieran Donaghy giving us their thoughts on the advanced mark and also on the Tier 2 Championship. It is going to be very interesting to see exactly what happens with the advanced mark and which teams suddenly become far better. You know, you have somebody in your team who might be able to kick 10, 12, 14 points from a game, slows down the game, the games stop becoming the ebb and flow that we've seen, and suddenly there are new contenders, you hope.
Yeah, I think Dublin will probably benefit from this the most.
Yeah.
Because they have the best coaching team. Like, whoever has the best coaching team is going to take advantage of this in the best way over the first couple of years of this until it becomes the norm, and then it's second nature for coaches to be.
I think there's a first year of this where random stuff happens and not everybody fully understands exactly what the implications of everything are.
I think a Jim Gavin team not fully understanding something is not a possibility.
It is, because they haven't done it before. There's new information coming to light.
There has, but like as I said there
on
a few
weekly
minutes
basis
ago,
in those games, you know.
I think the one thing that Dublin have actually got better at over the course of 2019 is being direct. And like, even if you take away the fact that they have the best set of coaches, they've actually kind of made the most improvements in terms of a direct team in and amongst the top teams in the country at the moment.
Maybe. The teams didn't defend them in a way that they were trying to stop them getting the mark. They defended them when they came down and they knew that they were going to, you know, so there's
it was that game against Cork in the Super 8s where Jack McCaffrey's racing down the left and people go to McCaffrey because he's Jack McCaffrey, and then he goes route one into Conor Callaghan and that's when he causes his damage. But then, like, what do you do then? Do you drop off Jack McCaffrey and put an extra man in front of Conor Callaghan? Granted, that's like one instance, and to be fair, that was one game where it was particularly pronounced. I can just see, like, you can, as soon as that passed at the weekend, Jim Gavin and his team are straight away thinking to themselves, how can we get the most out of this?
Who are
our forwards who can cause a bit of damage?
Maybe Connolly has like another 3 or 4 years of being the best kick passer in the country.
Like, you could put Connolly at either side of the advance mark and he'd be a success.
Yeah. Right, just want to mention this tonight. It's an event taking place in Harry Burns on the Howth Road in Clontarf in Dublin. It's an evening with Kevin Kilbane. It's all a native Down Syndrome Ireland. Tickets are €12 and can be bought in Harry Burns. It kicks off at 8 o'clock this evening. It's for a really good cause, so do support it if you can. All right, it's 8:31 this morning. We were down in Cork last night at the Crane Lane Theatre for the latest in our series of brilliant road shows with Heineken Rugby Club. We're going to bring you some of the rugby discussions a little later on OTBAM, and the full show will be broadcast across Off the Ball over the next few days. But we did have a bit of a Cork special last night as father and son, John and David Myler, joined Nathan on stage for a chat.
I sat in Anfield behind the goal one day, and this fella, I won't describe him to you, he sat alongside me and he spent 90 minutes abusing David. And
I wasn't playing that bad.
I did score. But you get guys on a Saturday over in England. This is their day. This is their. They're tanked up from drink from 6 o'clock in the morning. They're on the bus going to Liverpool, going to here, going to there. And they want their 5 minutes of fame, what they think, and they're going to abuse you. But in any job or any walk of life, we get abuse. It's how you take it.
You're right in what you're saying. It's more how you deal with it. Like, I've suffered from abuse over the years. I've seen a gentleman in here who I know very well, who runs a lot of bars. He knows who he is. I had bother a few years ago in here, and he said, come on, like, this can't go on. And I said, genuinely, I said, just get someone to sit down alongside me and watch. You'll just get, like, I'm not perfect. I don't think I'm perfect, you know, but fellas have cuts off you here, there and everywhere.
So what, when you just be back home?
I could just, yeah.
Bit of a dig?
Oh, yeah. But then you say, like, well, what do you say? You know, if I have a go at you, your first immediate response is to have a go back at me.
Right. That's amazing stuff. They're brilliant. And it's great to be able to have them together at the roadshow last night. Here's John, obviously, the father of an international footballer and former county manager, on his approach to praise. Oh, yeah, we'll get that in a second for you. So obviously the two lads were at the roadshow last night. I think a good bit of that's going to go out tonight, and then the rest of it probably going out tomorrow and some at the weekend as well.
Good father-son combination there. That's what you kind of like to see. It's always been an interesting dynamic from afar, because you'd often get to speak to one of them. I haven't really seen them do interviews together.
Not too much, no.
This might be the first one, actually, certainly in recent times. It's a great opportunity to listen to them. So, I'm not sure what they get into in terms of John himself, in terms of what's up next for him, because it's, and I will be very interested to hear what he has to say in his next clip, because...
Okay, we'll bring that clip now, yeah. So here they are talking about what their approach to praise is.
There is no point telling your children, and we all have great pride in our children, and you know, the way, whether they play, whatever sport they play, and I have great time for people who bring their kids playing hurling, football, soccer, swimming, whatever it is. And we all have great pride in our children and what they do and what they've achieved and succeeded over years. But, you know, sometimes you have to be, when he was good, we'd say nothing. And when he was bad, then you just pull him aside and say one or two things. And my father...
It was a lot more than one or two.
But my father, when he went to my matches, and I remember once I was playing for the Bars in the county final against the Glen in 81. We beat the Glen by a few points that day, and we were inside in the dressing room in the shower. We were having a shower, and I said, Jesus, there's two fellas with suits on outside in the middle of the dressing room standing like, you know, Nelson's Pillar. So we went out anyway, and right in the middle, two fellas in three-piece suits, like, and there was my father and my uncle had come from Wexford to watch the match, like, and he never said a word, like, bah. And it was only when I said it to David last night, It was only when he was dying in Wexford Hospital 19 years ago, and he said to my cousin was there, that he was proud of me. That he never said it to me. And, you know, it was only he told my cousin, you know, I was proud of him.
You know, so, are we blaming? We're not blaming
no,
you,
but
we're blaming Grandad.
Can I officially say I'm proud of him? But I'm proud of my daughter.
That's class. It's amazing stuff. That's John and David Myler last night at our Heineken Roadshow in Crane Lane in Cork. We'll bring you more of that good stuff across all of our social channels. Stay tuned to offtheball.com for more details on that coming your way. It's 8:36. What are we talking about next, Owen?
There's just a couple of stories in the newspapers which we didn't get to earlier on. I guess we may as well start with Turlough O'Brien. He's on the back page of the Irish Independent.
Following on from our conversation about is he positive, is he for or again the new Tier 2 Championship?
Well, the headline says, horrific decision taken by out-of-touch delegates. So I'm going to go ahead and say he's against the new Tier 2 Championship. A horrifically bad decision that has no chance of being successful, he says. There will be a revolution unless we decide who we are, what we stand for, and where we are going as an organisation. So he basically wants a major strategic review to be undertaken across every area of activity, 17 years since the last major report, which I guess is kind of a valid point. Like, how often should these major reports happen? Like, you often kind of cringe at the prospect of a major report because it's such an easy thing to say, but, like, should these not be done at regular intervals anyway? Like, should there not have been a sort of check-in on, for example, the major reports surrounding Dublin, perhaps 5 years later and then 10 years later?
Yeah.
Like, should it not be...
rolling thing where we can... There's a health check where you go, is this working or not? What are the changes?
And then we end up coming across as panicky and frantic when the term kind of major inquest, root and branch reform is kind of thrown about at a time of crisis. Because I think using the word crisis around the GEA isn't a step too far. Some people would say that they are at a crisis. They are certainly at a crossroads, to put it mildly. And actually, why do you get to this point? Well, it is comes from a lack of planning, or comes from a lack of evaluation as to where the organisation may be at. Now, granted, like, you do wonder what have been the major crises that the GEA have faced since then. Like, there has been multiple different things. Like, when you think of any organisation in Ireland, like, you're probably coming to a stage of post-crisis over the last 5 years. Like, was the GEA ever in financial ruin? Was it ever in a place where it had to kind of survive the economic crash and then everything else went by the wayside? I'm not so sure about that. I think there would have been an actual opportunity for this to have been done, for stock to have been taken throughout that period, throughout the turn of the decade. Whereas now we've just progressed into more of a wormhole of professionalism, where the gap has got bigger, where the disconnect between the club and the county players has got bigger, and the gap between Tier 1 and Tier 2 has got bigger, to the point where this new championship has just been thrown together. So I think he has a point. But ultimately, he was talking about the Tier 2 and how it's just a horrific decision.
Interesting piece from Carlo Kane in The Star today. Chasing Dubs has left Mayo in a mess. So it's there you go. It's a picture of Elbridge McHale Park and Aidan O'Shea and this guy, Tim O'Leary, who's the benefactor, who is essentially dictating the agenda around Mayo GAA at the moment. Because all of the stories that are coming out are in response to stuff that has ultimately been leaked, but has been back and forth by email between him and the county board, him requesting details on a possibility of becoming the title sponsor for McHale Park and also the title sponsor on the jerseys. He wanted to see exactly how that decision-making process was going to happen, and ultimately that ends up being leaked to the papers. But Carla Kane has an interesting take on it, saying that chasing Dublin is one of the things that has left Mayo in the parlous financial state they're in. They've built this massive stadium, saddled themselves with debt. The debt repayments are one of the things that requires them to fundraise so spectacularly. And the other thing is raising money to make sure that they're able to pay for the support team to make the football team nearly as good as Dublin. And ultimately that means you end up having to go to people like Tim O'Leary and getting them involved and giving them the power of asking, where's my money going? And it's not a great situation you find yourselves in, but he's made an interesting kind of point about the Dubs and their essential refusal to build their own stadium. They have the use of Croke Park, and as a result, they've been able to invest their money in whatever it is they want to do, which is the team, or they've obviously bought the land around the spa well. But there's no sign of that being redeveloped just yet. They still haven't had to fundraise to build their centre of excellence. And he's making the point that Meath and Louth are currently in the throes of multi-million euro stadium redevelopments. Two neighbours about to spend millions and burden themselves with debt for years to come. It's too late now, but would one 10,000 capacity stadium in Drogheda not have done the pair of them? A stadium on the M1 that other counties could have used, and if Meath or Louth need Croke Park, then go to Croke Park. It's baffling that no one takes note of what Dublin are doing here, which is absolutely nothing. It's a good point.
Yeah, it has been mentioned before as well. Like, ultimately, if you're in Dublin's position, you're saying to yourself, well, we can get Croke Park whenever you want. Why on earth would we be spending money that we actually don't need to spend because we have an absolutely ideal situation? Like, but even on the GEA's front, are they turning around and saying to themselves, well, actually, no, Dublin, you can go and do your own thing now. You will not be getting Croke Park for your home games. Go and spend millions of euro.
No, because that would make no sense.
Exactly.
So,
like, I think it's worth pointing out, and I think it's worth pointing out in terms of what a disadvantage other counties are at. But, like, what does it change on Dublin's front? I'm not sure is there an actual move to be had here, or is there an actual change to be had here?
No, but it's like doing nothing. It's like, don't be investing all your money in stadiums that are going to be used 5 or 6 times a year and that are never full.
That's definitely true.
Like, maybe full once a year. Like, he makes the point when Armagh won the All-Ireland, they had no county ground. Did it matter a jot? Whatever money they had went to their training ground in Callan Bridge. For Mayo, though, there's no going back now. And, you know, this... Like,
ultimately, there is more to what the county board spends than the success of the inter-county team. Like, I'm sure Armagh GEA has benefited hugely from the development of a ground. Like I'm sure Mayo GEA would benefit hugely if Elvery's Park was in. Like, I mean, just even...
How do you benefit from having a massive ground that isn't used properly?
Like, I'm not talking about the senior team, I'm talking about the people of Mayo, the people who are part of Mayo GEA, the people who attend Mayo GEA matches on a Saturday night during the league, who attend their club games now over the next couple of weeks, actually having a decent ground to go to. It's like, right, I pay my membership to actually, as part of my club. My club is part of the county board. You know what, give us a half-decent ground and facilities.
Be a 10,000 all-seater or like a 45,000, like, white elephant?
Like, I'm not suggesting white elephant for one second.
But that's what we built. That's what we decided. That's what we decided we needed. Like, most of these grounds are far too big in almost every county. Like, I don't know. I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me.
Like, actually starting from scratch and building these ginormous stadiums, relatively ginormous, like, okay, that does not make sense one bit. But ultimately, looking at where our finances are going within a county GEA setup, and just saying that, well, more should be going into the inter-county team is kind of counterproductive and kind of, it's definitely not counterproductive. It will be productive for the team, but it kind of goes against what the GEA kind of is. Like, county boards have other things to spend on. And granted, if you had some sort of special fund that went directly into inter-county teams, then that's great. If that's what your trips to America is based on, that's solely for the inter-county team or whatever it may be, then fantastic. But say if our Elvery's money is actually going to fund everything to do with Mayo GEA, it's going to fund grassroots, it's going to fund coaching, development officers, then fantastic. Because that ultimately, for me, is the most important thing.
Yeah, I would. Well, that's where everything comes from. But ultimately, if you've got a big stadium, you've got to repay your debts.
It's a disaster.
Yeah. Anthony Moyles again, lots of brilliant ideas being presented within the fixtures task force. Why not wait for the findings? Why try and wedge this in now? I guess that's the whole point of GEA politics, really. And that's the system that we have, and the system will always work that way. But these are excellent questions, and I guess we haven't really got the answer to that. Unless, unless this is a bridge to something else, but like the qualifiers were the same qualifiers for 19 years. Like, they were never bridged to anything else. They were, that's it now, get on with it, stop whining, it is what it is, and we won't hear any more.
That's true. We actually haven't had a huge amount of evidence of stepping stones in the past.
No.
And I definitely have got sucked into this idea that Super 8, for example, was part of something bigger, but as you said, there has never been evidence of that in the past.
It turns out it wasn't.
Yeah. And it's going to be binned. I'd be very surprised if it doesn't get binned after the final year. Just like one final thing on that, like in terms of how decisions are made in the GEA, like it is, it's beyond embarrassing that Congress still exists in the way that it does. Like, if we want real change, Congress is just—it's just not the way to go. And there is this kind of illusion that it serves everybody in the GEA, but it really doesn't. Like, I mean, Mayo people wake up this week and they actually see that they're not even represented by their county board person at Congress. But like, to even suggest that county board men or women actually represent the real interests of GAA people in their county would be a bit of a stretch and doing them way more of a service than they actually deserve, because that's not how it works. That there were other things, like there were kind of I scratch your back, all that sort of thing, and that's how Congress tends to work, and it is kind of an archaic mechanism for decision making. Made by quite often people who just don't actually understand what is required to move this organisation onto the next level, and even to their own county's interest, what it takes to move them onto the next level. Like, I don't know, it's been, like, the last 48 hours since I've come home, I've just been catching up on the Tier 2 Congress. I wish I hadn't come home. It's a very demoralising thing, actually reading up on Congress and actually seeing how these decisions are made and listening to all of this. And, it flies in the face of even the kind of basic principle of what the GAA has been recently, which is a slow-moving dinosaural organisation that actually suddenly do something really quickly, and it actually just doesn't make sense. It's actually quite an erratic decision from the GAA. So I don't know.
8:46 a.m. this morning. We're moving back to rugby, are you?
Yeah, just one last one here. Farrell is England's Roy Keane. Captain has the same uncompromising, fiery and combative attitude as United legend. And I love it. This is Clive Woodward, who is talking in the Irish Daily Mail this morning, saying that he's always viewed Owen Farrell as a dogs of war player, a sporting blood brother to Roy Keane, one of my favourite footballers. Hard as nails, incredibly competitive and uncompromising, fiery and combative. Yet also sublimely skillful and talented. Basically just making the point that Owen Farrell doesn't laugh and joke around with the opposition players before a game, that he has this will to win, which he can't really be topped within the England team. Outside of that, really, I'm not so sure if there's too much of a comparison to be made. Like, I mean, Jonathan Sexton would be a Roy Keane character if you put it down to that sort of level, wouldn't he?
Say that again?
As in the sort of before a game, this is a hugely competitive fixture for me. This is a hugely competitive moment for me. I'm not joking around with my opposition teammates or anything like that. This is war. This is what matters. And the fieriness that we see on the pitch is, I guess, representative of the way Keane would have been. I don't know. It's
well, he said it this week, laughing and joking with each other in the tunnel before the must have been Liverpool Man United game at the weekend, where he was disgusted with it.
And he's discussing with that at every occasion that comes up. It comes up quite a bit. You saw Christian Pulisic when he came on last night. Actually, high five the right back from Ajax, the other United States international. Roy Keane would have been absolutely squirming in a seat wherever he was watching that last night.
Yeah. Okay. There's a couple of other things in the papers today that we wanted to get to. So I don't know if you saw Ethan Asiwa come out yesterday and talked about, he had some fairly interesting information about how Ireland had changed their style of play a little bit. In the 2017-2018 season, once Leinster started playing an attacking brand of rugby and the majority of the Ireland squad was Leinster based, they let a little bit of that Leinster flair infiltrate the Ireland camp. This is Asiwa talking with Sky in New Zealand. Joe started to go away from his tried and trusted drills and introduced a bit of what we call unstructured play. That came into Ireland camp and training in the Six Nations, and they were throwing offloads. There was continuity to their play. That got them all the way to the top of the world and an unbeaten year with all their trophies. Post that, I hear they actually went away from that and started to take it back out and went back to the conservative approach. And that's just shone through the whole World Cup in 2019, which is more information that we've had coming out of the Ireland camp from Ethan Asiwa on the far side of the world. Gary Thorne's got a piece today saying the headline is Nasiwa invariably did the right thing but not this time, and he's saying that if there was a list of players who I thought was going to criticise Joe Schmidt, Nasiwa would have been last, well maybe second last after Johnny Sexton, because obviously Nasiwa had been involved in the recruitment of Joe Schmidt to Leinster. They'd asked him, because he'd worked with him, you know, what do you think of this guy, and he went, oh, he's Mr. Rugby, and so they did get him. Thorny's not sure that Nasiwa must also have known his words will carry so much weight with Leinster supporters who chanted his name repeatedly and who adored Schmidt as much. Now they'll be divided in this one. As the wonderful player he was, one of Nasiwa's great strengths was that he invariably did the right thing. He may even be correct in some or all of what he said, but not sure he's done the right thing here. I think he's done exactly the right thing. He's given his opinion when he's been asked for it about what the hell happened. He's used the information that he has, which is clearly from people within the camp, and he's gone public with it. And this is exactly the type of reporting and opinion that we need from our former players. Like, the first thing I thought of when I saw Nasiwa's stuff was like, let's get him on, let's talk a bit about that. Because, and actually, I had the thought during the week, wouldn't it be great to have somebody like him involved? You know, he had that year of being a skills coach, and obviously he's back down in New Zealand now, but like somebody who understands the rugby culture of a different place and the rugby culture of here, it might be nice to have him involved somewhere along the way. But I think he's done exactly the right thing. He said, and it must have been really hard for him to say that, because he clearly got on very well with Schmidt. And I think we should be welcoming that, as opposed to saying it's the wrong thing to do.
Yeah, it's a brave thing to do as well on his part. It's interesting what he says, though. Like, I mean, we've been saying, was 2018 the real Ireland, and then 2019 kind of a B version of it. Maybe actually Joe Schmidt thought that 2018 was kind of the B version of Ireland, and actually we're going to keep a powder dry, and then boom, first game of the Six Nations, we're going to hit England with what we've really got, and then that just crumbled everything.
Yeah, I don't know, more of that from Issa, I would argue, as opposed to less of that. Alright, sports news from Phil Egan coming next, but after another good night for Liverpool in Europe, Graham Souness singled out Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain for praise live on Virgin Media Sport.
That's an obvious criticism, that, you know, Liverpool midfield players don't get enough goals. You don't want to share them round. Over-reliance on just the front three to get the goals. In the same breath, it's hard to be critical of Liverpool's midfield, because there's so much to like about them. Honest types, you know, Wijnaldum, Henderson, James Milner when he's in there, Fabinho, all very honest types. I don't think it's either or. I think it's, you know, you can still be a workaholic, but have craft. And I think Oxlade-Chamberlain has a physical ability to be that working player, but also add that little bit of specialness, you know, that magic at the right times. And his career is just hopefully getting off for him now, because he had an ACL when he injured it last year.
Do you think Klopp is saying to him, if you give me the work rates that the others provide, I have a role for you?
I think if you ask any supporter at any team, you know, that should be a given, shouldn't it? I'm going to work my socks off. When I come off, I've got nothing else to give. You know, I'm completely knackered. I'll give you everything, boss. But he is a special player. I think there's a real player in there. And, you know, every game's different. Like, he came off the bench on last Sunday against Man United. He had a shot like that, just whistled past the post early on when he came on. I think, you know, there's definitely a place for him in that team. Mm. Might not be every game, might not start every game, but there's definitely a place for him.
Virgin Media Sport has over 400 UEFA Champions League, Europa League and Nations League games live this season, and is available to all Virgin Media TV customers. You can also download the TV Anywhere app. Check out the hashtag WeFreeSport for more. Phil Egan, how are you?
Very well, yeah. Good goal from Ox. Good two goals, but the second one in particular.
Not bad.
Wasn't bad.
A bit of guile.
Yeah. He played Keita and Oxlade-Chamberlain. And, you know, when you saw the team, you thought, oh, yeah, exciting team. But then you realise after a few minutes that the back four were completely exposed, because the two lads were getting forward so much. So if Liverpool hit a straight pass, they were completely exposed. And when you've got someone like Dejan Lovren, who just doesn't really hold his position, he just wants to get stuck in as quick as he can. So Genk got in a few times in the first half an hour. They actually put the ball in the net where it was disallowed by VAR. But there's a few times they got in, and Alisson had to make a good save. Fullbacks had to come around and cover. But that would be the only concern, that they weren't really that familiar.
That'll build, all right. Yeah. More than that responsibilities, and they'll work that out. Like,
three lads up front, they all clicked again last night. Mane's goal in particular. Firmino plays at the Salah to Mane.
Lovely. They're friends again.
Yeah. I said it yesterday, I kind of fancy Liverpool to do a number on Spurs on Sunday.
Right.
Where, you know, there'll be, I think it'll click at Anfield on Sunday for them. And
Spurs aren't properly back. Like, just before that, like, I don't want to get carried away with the result against Genk, but last night kind of felt very, very significant for me in terms of what Liverpool might do in the Premier League.
Yeah.
Like, so you look at the comparisons. There's always going to be the comparison between Liverpool and Manchester City. Look at it last year. Liverpool could match them player for player in pretty much every position. What player did they not have? It's a sort of advanced number eight, or whatever kind of jargon Manchester City tend to use for it. A Kevin De Bruyne type player. And you even mentioned it on the show yesterday, that perhaps midfield has been an area where Liverpool need to work on. And that second finish from Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain yesterday was absolutely out of this world.
Unbelievable.
It's absolutely unbelievable. Yeah. If Kevin De Bruyne does that, you're saying to yourself, this is the reason why he's the best midfielder in the world. Like, Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain and his ceiling, I don't think people appreciate, is unbelievably high. Like, he has the potential to not only be the best Liverpool midfielder that they currently have, but to be one of the best in the Premier League, to be one of the best in that position, which, like, you know, he kind of started off as a winger, kind of, I would have thought, before he left Arsenal, kind of an erratic midfielder. When he leaves, you start to appreciate, actually, he was unbelievably consistent. And the injury actually slowed down this guy's progression to going right to the very top. And this is a fella, like, I know you don't want to get carried away with a performance against Genk, but I'm sure most Liverpool fans would agree that before that injury, his trajectory was going sky high.
Yeah.
And with that sort of weapon in the armoury now, that is the final piece of the jigsaw for me in terms of Liverpool going on to win the Premier League.
But even just think back to the season that he did get injured. He scored against City. Those goals last night were his first goals since the quarter-final win over City a couple of seasons ago in the Champions League. He scored in the league game against City as well. Just where he just burns players and he can finish. Now, the way Klopp has set it up, Fabinho is starting. And, you know, you'd imagine Henderson is going to start most of the big games. So it's A and other. Is it Wijnaldum? Is it Keita? Is it Oxlade-Chamberlain? So he mightn't be a regular.
Like, I think on last night's evidence, there's every chance that this guy's the best midfielder that Liverpool have.
Can you not pay Fabinho, Keita and the Ox?
Which they did last night.
They did last night, and look, it was the first time they did it. And, you know, they're only going to get more familiar the more they do it. But the thing, I suppose the good thing from the Ox is he's definitely not even near being back to his full sharpness because that injury was out for so long. And He took him off last night, more minutes under his belt. So you'd imagine the more he plays, the better he's going to get. But I just wonder, are they just keeping an eye on him to think, you know, just have to manage his game time?
Hmm.
But that's the way Klopp is doing at the moment. He pretty much picks the same back four if he can. The front three picks itself. So the only chance for rotation is in midfield. So I think he's just going to keep rotating.
I can see them being rotated, but in the big games, you're saying Henderson's always going to start.
Yeah, I kind of get that feel. Like, depends how they want to play. So when they play Spurs now on Sunday, they'll want to get in at Spurs from the start, and Henderson has that. You know, he'll set the tone in midfield that they'll try and pin Spurs back. And he didn't start last night, so you'd imagine he was being
rested. Yeah. Okay. All right, Phil, I know you've got to run off and do a bulletin, but you'll come back to us in a couple of minutes, maybe?
Yeah.
Do
you know what? I'll come back and I'll have the England team for you because obviously the World Cup semi-finals are this weekend. New Zealand have made one change from the win over Ireland. Scott Barrett is in for Sam Kane. England will name their team in the next few minutes. And then there's a blow for South Africa. Cheslin Kolbe won't play. He is out of the semi-final against Wales on Sunday due to an ankle injury. So Sibu Nkosi is in. That's the only change from the win over Japan.
All right, good stuff. We'll let you go for now. Thanks a million for that. So we're going to chat to Graham Hunter after this. But first, Damien Delaney blew up the internet and off the ball last night. Here's how.
Maradona comes in fourth on the list of all time.
Fourth.
I mean, you two are harping on there about Pele, Maradona, and then your man chucks
Di
Stefano in. I mean, listen, Cristiano number one for me.
Damien.
Pele number two for me. And Leo number three for me. And Diego coming in a distant fourth. A distant fourth to them three.
I'm having that.
Listen, he won a World Cup in 86, a couple of Serie A's, and then lost the plot.
I'd probably well lose the part if I was there.
Probably has a good couple of stories, but you know the consistency that the other three have, the longevity they have, their stats, their trophies. If you want to, you know, you were a young boy in '86, and you know Mexico '86 holds some special memory for you. Yeah. Great, you know, but that doesn't put him in the all-time.
That's the most patronising great thing I've ever heard. You're a great, fair play.
There's no room for feeling in this debate.
Whatever, it's grand. Let's deal with
we're cold hard facts tonight.
You're just dealing with stats. You're a cold stats man.
No facts. Right. You know,
stats and facts are
I'm telling
different
you.
Things.
Telling you.
Yeah, so that got some reaction.
So what was it? Maradona fourth, Pele third,
Cristiano, Pele, Messi, Maradona distant fourth.
Pele ahead of Messi is obviously going to be the most contentious.
thinking Cristiano the greatest player of all time ahead of Pele, Messi, and Maradona.
Well, there's obviously a case to be made for Ronaldo over Messi. It's a matter of taste.
It's not really.
Well, like, I mean, the sort of effectiveness of Cristiano Ronaldo.
And is sport just about effectiveness, Owen?
Exactly. For me, it's not. For me, it's not. I'm a messy guy, despite, you know, the whatever two-year-old war we had with kids on the internet, remember, with FIFA 2018 or whatever it was. For me, he's the greatest of all time. But also, I don't think putting Ronaldo ahead of Messi is the most contentious thing there. I think putting Pelé ahead of Messi is, like, people might even take a harder line of that in terms of to what extent is Pelé's record, which he cited there, legitimate. And
irrespective of whether or not he scored the 1,100 goals or whatever it was over his career, because they're probably including the five sides that he was involved in. But he also is like the most effective version of Ronaldo before Ronaldo was Ronaldo, like, and was centrally involved in a team that won 3 World Cups.
Mm.
Like, starting as a 17-year-old. If we're talking, the argument for Cristiano is based on effectiveness.
Yes.
Pele's effectiveness is even higher than Cristiano's at a more important level, the World Cup, rather than, like, Cristiano and a World Cup. I don't see one. Like, I'm looking around for your trophy there.
So if Pele plays in that Portugal team, did they win a World Cup?
I mean, I don't know. It's like if Cristiano plays in that Brazil team, I'm not sure they do. I don't, like, you know, we can't put them in. There's no actual
FIFA program that allows us
to do it.
And there's no way of us deciding whether or not Demi Delaney is right or wrong here, and that's why the debate exists, and this could be a facet of the debate. Like,
but I don't think... I don't know. I can't... I can't be chuckling with people putting Cristiano and Pelé in the same...
Like, it's much easier to have a Ronaldo versus Messi debate, and that's why we're so sick of it. So, fair play to Demi Delaney for mixing it up, firing the debate into a time machine, and just staggering Pelé and Maradona in there.
Graham Hunter is with us. Graham, good morning to you.
Good morning, gentlemen. And I wasn't anywhere in the list, I guess.
Fifth, I think. Just off.
Thank you.
Pelé versus Cristiano.
You know, because I wasn't privileged to come into the beginning of your discussion, I don't know if you recounted the thing that I have told you before, but given Damien's boldness, it was always Ronaldo's wish to be listed as the best footballer of all time. One of the things that the great debate has ignored when it's been, oh, Messi does this, Ronaldo does this, the number of trophies, oh, la, 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 was that Cristiano set himself that goal of being... Messi has always just been an inconvenience to him until they fell in love a couple of seasons ago and augmented that when they went to two different... when they're playing in two different countries. It's now a real kissy-kissy fest, isn't it? You know, I miss you and I miss you. Valter Di Salvo was a contact of mine when he was at Manchester United and then subsequently at Real Madrid as fitness conditioning coach. He's now... over at the Aspire Academy in Qatar. And he was, by a long distance, Ronaldo's closest confidant at Old Trafford. And it was Valter Di Salvo who shared to me one time in an interview that, you know, Cristiano's goal is to be regarded as the greatest footballer of all time. And I don't know if you saw, like, this mad relationship that Jorge Mendes and Cristiano have. Mendes recently, he wins this award every year, doesn't he? I don't know what it's called, Globe or Globo or whatever. However he's playing, there's this award somewhere out in the desert that Cristiano wins, and Mendes is the best agent every year. And they pick up the trophies and they love that kind of nonsense. And Mendes, I saw recently going, you know, Cristiano's still by far the greatest player of all time. So, you know, there are, I'm not saying Damien's, you know, in the Mendes stable or is under any kind of Portuguese influence, but there are people who genuinely want that to be the case, that to be the argument that Cristiano's, and really in terms of pure football, never mind trophies won, like that little old joke about he's not even the best Ronaldo is true, because Brazilian Ronaldo as a footballer, and some would say even in terms of what he displayed, given that none of the three of us would talk Cristiano down in that he has been an amazing athlete. He's been an amazing boon to people who earn their living like we do. Spectators all over the world have been given countless thrills from him. And he's a master of theatre because he loves centre stage.
Yeah.
And my respect for him is huge. But in football terms, he's the lesser of the two Ronaldos.
Well, that's interesting, because I did want to ask you about the real Ronaldo. It's 5 minutes past nine for anybody just tuning in. We're talking with Graham Hunter here on OTB AM. I'm going to get to talk to the real Ronaldo at the Web Summit in about 10 days' time. He's picking up the same award that George Mendes got last year, funnily enough, speaking about awards. And it got me thinking about, like, where is his place in the world game at the moment? Because he kind of becomes a little bit forgotten about when you consider that for that period between, I don't know, 93, 94, whenever he burst on the scene at PSV, all the way up to the end of the World Cup in 2002, like, we all want to see him play. We're desperately concerned about the fate of his knee and how his career might not actually end up fulfilling itself. And then ultimately it does.
I think the period lasts longer, Jer, in that, you know, at Real Madrid, while once he'd healed at Inter and went to Real Madrid, although he was a little bit rounder, certainly bigger than he was at PSV, when he just looked, he was the most amazing athlete. You know, he won the title at Real Madrid. There were goals just flooded off his boot. And he still played brilliantly until age and just that slight weight gain that he had at the latter stage of his playing career caught up with him. So I would go that from, you know, before he reaches PSV, when we didn't know of him, you know, that there wasn't the internet there, the coverage of Brazilian football wasn't fantastic. But through to his days at Real Madrid when he was exceptional, you know, the period lasted longer when he could do anything with a defender. He could do it. His finishing, I think, you know, I'd love to have been able to see, like, the massive Swedish trio, Granoli trio, at AC Milan, who scored goals for fun, who I don't think none of us saw live, and there isn't footage of them, particularly Nils Lidholm. And, you know, there have been others, Hughie Gallagher. I wasn't old enough to see Jimmy Greaves at his absolute height. I grew up watching Gert Müller, and his finishing power was extraordinary. But Ronaldo, one-on-one with a keeper, I can't remember him failing, and I can't remember not enjoying the finish. It was a show all in itself, irrespective of, you know, his power, his ability to turn on a sixpence, how many players he would run past, how many players he could hold off. He finished, in my opinion, like a brilliant snooker player. The ball was always arrowed away diagonally. He seemed to have this perception, Brazilian Ronaldo, of, if I put this diagonally now across the goalkeeper, you know, his weight's on his right foot, so I'll put it to his right because he's just using his right foot to push to his left and vice versa. The finishing, it was preternatural what he could do. He was fantastic to watch. He was a really elegant footballer who, at his best, his feet didn't seem to touch the ground. He glided over the ground. A total package. And I watched, you know, I was reporting then. I was lucky enough to meet him, to be at some of his games, both internationally and for at least, yeah, two club sides I saw him play for. For my money, he, top three, lists are difficult and treacherous.
Yeah.
But if we did a simple comparison without looking at achievements, trophies, he was a more complete footballer, far more complete footballer than Cristiano Ronaldo. And if we could do this Frankenstein's laboratory and put Cristiano's extraordinary athleticism, extraordinary will to dominate, to push everything aside to be the best, which is something that is probably under-examined and probably sometimes we mock Cristiano for wanting it so much. And I hate that. I really admire that. If you could apply that to my career, then I'd be retired by now. And if Ronaldo, Brazilian Ronaldo, had had that utter, ruthless desire to be the best and stay the best instead of enjoying life, then there wouldn't be a debate. Ronaldo would be the all-time number one.
Yeah, fair enough. I wanted to ask you a little bit about a couple of things, in particular Barca's performance last night. Their form is patchy at the moment, and they got their fill of it last night in Prague against Slavia Prague, but they came away with a win. Is this one of those group stages matches where all that really matters ultimately is making sure that you're grand at the end of the standings and that you're going through and you've got the top seed from the group?
depends whose colours you wear. You know, I'm a real football romantic, and although I've earned my living a great deal from being in the same city as the greatest Barcelona team of all time, teams, and because I wrote a book about them and a film about them, I'm associated with them. My love is for football, not for them, and Aberdeen miles beyond them. I don't carry Barca colours. And therefore, standing back objectively, what I saw was 90 minutes of just an extraordinary football match. I absolutely adored. The warning signs were there. I haven't seen Slavia this season. The warning signs came from Valverde pre-match, Gerard. So the 90 minutes that we witnessed that you've been talking about there, I'm not sure if either of you, your attentions might have been drawn elsewhere last night in the Champions League, and I would understand that because there were some truly big games. Valverde's tone in the press conference before the match told you exactly, it wasn't fear, but how much he respected the quality that Slavia had, but the brand of football that they proposed. You could have begun calling it toe-to-toe, but when those toes kept running them past Barca players, then you had to abandon that idea. Slavia's wit, their creativity, their energy, and it wasn't buzz bomb, will just outwork Football Club Barcelona, although they outran them, I guess, totally by 12, 13 kilometres on the night. The passing, the speed of passing, the work for each other. Slavia were a joy to watch. It was one of the most thrilling 90 minutes I can remember for many, many years. And therefore, not being a Barca fan, I looked at them and I saw things to like. I saw a huge deluge of Barca fans on the internet subsequent to the game jumping on, dumping on their team. We're trash away from home. Suarez is an idiot. Just the abuse was endless. They're not fully formed right now. Their cog, their main central cog, Sergio Busquets, is suffering athletically. His form in the last two games, he's done things with the ball that resemble the old Sergio Busquets, and De Jong and Arthur have their ups and downs. Two young men still learning positional football. They're both extremely good, but neither of them has been trained in the Barca way, and therefore Busquets is sometimes underprotected or left looking for guys to pass the ball to instantly that resemble what Xavi Iniesta did, and those guys aren't there. So there was stuff to see when Barca attacked. There was a cogent plan. There was a team play. They made umpteen chances. The game should have been 6-5 to one of the two sides, and therefore Valverde will come away with a really clear idea that his team is at it mentally, that they're competitive again, and that two things need to happen. His training of how the midfield supports Busquets and close the lines so that there aren't so many gaps and keep the ball better, that's one pending task. And the other one is getting fitter, because just as we saw at Anfield, there is now a mode whereby they think they can keep the ball so they don't need to be ultra dynamic like some of the elite teams in Europe are now. But when they don't keep the ball, they get trampled on. And that's the two pending tasks that come out of last night. But just in terms, if you wanted to spend an evening and you couldn't get to Prague watching football, that was the one to choose. It was extraordinary.
Yeah, it definitely was. And I mean, looking at last night's fixtures elsewhere, we were speaking about Liverpool a moment ago, but I think Chelsea kind of has this greater significance at the moment. Like, whenever we think of great, young, bright managers at the moment, we're usually reading about it in La Liga or particularly the Bundesliga at the moment. So I'd be very interested to get your take on Frank Lampard and what he's done so far. Like, there's kind of two sides of the fence in terms of whether or not the transfer ban has helped or hindered him, has been forced into a youthful style, a youthful kind of age profile when it comes to this team. I'd like to kind of take the optimistic view on it and say that Lampard is actually an excellent manager and excellent working with kids, and he's got a squad of players that he can mould into a great European side. Like, winning in Amsterdam is no small feat.
I agree with you, and I think they merited it, albeit I actually moan about Quincy's offside goal, which was by, you know, 1/100 of a millimetre. You know, I came over to your country in summer, where Chelsea were training, and I spent a day out in that beautiful country lodge where they worked for a week. And the first thing I'd answer you by saying is that what we saw last night and what we've seen increasingly regularly is exactly what Frank Lampard said in the interview that I did with him, was their number one priority, which was to increase intensity in transitions. He felt that he'd inherited a squad whereby they were very good in the ball, and that bringing it forward or passing it forward was something that he'd inherited from Sarri. And that when possession broke down, the intensity of recuperation, that sort of, well, we'll gradually troop back and at some stage we'll have it again, and then off we go again. That wasn't good enough for him. I think that Chelsea have become a side whereby the first thing that they do is that they're at least as quick, maybe quicker with the ball than under Sarri. It's a little bit less developed play, but it's a version of what they had last season, and that makes sense because some of the key footballers that made that system work, what was it, a final, a winning final in top four, so Sarri's performance was good. Frank Lampard knew he was inheriting, you know, a more than decent squad. And the work that they wanted to do, and I say they because I think it's really important, genuinely, when you're putting a magnifying glass on what you've seen of Frank Lampard so far, I respect hugely the fact that Joe Edwards was a successful youth coach when Chelsea were consistently winning the UEFA Youth League. And some of those pupils have come through. I think Jody Morris is an exceptional coach.
Right.
Much undervalued as a footballer. I think that he is a really, really good organiser, tactician, teacher. And Frank Lampard is football bright and a leader. And also somebody who gives off, you know, you both have met because you're multi-sport. There are certain sports people, men and women, who just exude character, leadership. There's a certain, what would you call it, charisma. And Lampard has that. So whatever, accepting his football brain, he is a born leader. A combination of three men, I think, has made Chelsea exciting to watch. I think it's brought, I mean, notable things. Pulisic doesn't get a lot of game time, yet you can see that his development is continuing. Tammy Abraham was a guy who many people thought, Gerald have his views, had too many opportunities to score the goals that he got at Aston Villa. I put a little punt on at the beginning of the season. I said that Tammy Abraham might compete to be one of the top 2-3 scorers in the Premier League at the end of this season. And I did that because I fully expected him, one, to keep Giroud out of the team regularly, two, to be served well, and three, to be taught a lot about finishing. I think that's happening. And I'll finish by saying that, in my opinion, the bedrock of a team that Lampard and Jody Morris particularly want to play this way, to have Jorginho and Kante, is just a gift from the heavens for them. Jorginho is, I couldn't believe the grief he was given by some media in England last season. Jorginho, to my mind, is an extraordinary footballer. Pair him with Kante, and then you've got your spine. You're working on what else to do to add filigree. So yeah. They were lucky men as coaches to inherit those two.
Graham, great to have you with us again. Thanks a million for joining us.
You too.
Graham Hunter giving us some thoughts there. 18 minutes past 9 this morning. All this week on OTBAM, we've been giving you the chance to win UEFA Champions League quarter-final tickets with thanks to Pepsi Max, one of the proud sponsors of the UEFA Champions League. To be given the chance of winning this morning, share the show wherever you're watching or listening and send us your first Champions League memory. Remember, if you don't win on OTBAM this morning, there are more ways to win with 20 tickets up for grabs for games in the Champions League group stages. Check out pepsimax.ie for more details there. Pepsi Max, maximum taste, no sugar. Some of the entries this morning. The 92 final in Wembley, Barcelona against Sampdoria. I remember that one well. Ronald Koeman free kick to score the winner. Lost a few balls trying to recreate that in the back garden. David O'Grady, first real memory of the Champions League was September 15, 1993. Man United versus Kishpest Honved in the first round. They won 3-2 with Keno getting a nice brace. Hashtag OTBAM. Liked, following and retweeted. Unshin Mack says, first Champions League memory was Red Star Belgrade winning a terrible final versus Marseille in 91. Is that the nil-all draw goes to penalties? Or is it, I don't know, I've blanked that one from my memory. It's definitely Barcelona and Steaua Bucharest that goes to penalties. Steaua beat them? Is that right? Did Steaua win it? Did they beat Gary Lineker's team? Was that a Champions Cup? Was that a Champions League final, European Cup final. 97 final, Dortmund against Juve. Dortmund's kit stands out in my memory, and also Lars Ricken's chip over Peruzzi. Great strike. We're back with the latest sports news and Phil Egan after these.
OTB AM.
All right, you're very welcome back. Phil is here with us. Very good morning to you, Phil.
Good morning. Good to be back. Yeah.
20 past nine. It's been a long time.
Yeah, how you doing?
The England team names?
Yeah, as expected. It's George Ford comes back in. Henry Slade drops out. So Farrell moves back into the centre beside Tuilagi. Yeah, that's you kind of feel whoever wins that game is going to win it.
If
England win, Wales are going to beat them in the final.
Wales have a good chance of beating England.
But then the problem is the box group's going to smash Wales on Sunday. That's all.
They're going to have to do it without Cheslin Colby.
Yeah,
everything is coming up Warren Gatland right now. Everything. It is Yeah, I did just replicate that everything's coming up Middlehouse and just put in Warren Gatland's name, because that's how it works. The Colby injury is huge news. It's a huge boon for Wales. And if England manage to do the job on Saturday, it's another one.
Will England do the job, though?
The path is clear.
They've got a good chance. They have a chance. I certainly would give them...
A much better chance than we had. Well, definitely.
They have, people who... Even if things are going badly, you can just give the ball to and they'll make a little bit of momentum for you, and that gives you the opportunity to get your people running off them. You've got to make New Zealand big favourites, right? They are big favourites and they should win.
I'm not sure about big favourites. Favourites for sure.
6 to 8 point favourites? Yeah, that's big favourites.
Look, is that what they are?
I'm going to check now.
I would say 4 or 5 point favourites.
I look back at the first 10 minutes of England-Australia. Australia have all the ball. They just can't get through the England defence, and England...
7 point favourites.
Withstand that start. But if they give that amount of ball to New Zealand, New Zealand will get in. And then if you're chasing New Zealand, forget about it. But if England start well, certainly they have a chance. It's a pity. I think this would be the perfect final. But
England, New Zealand?
Yeah, maybe class.
A New Zealand Wales final would also be great, because Wales at least have. Wales don't need all the ball to score against you.
No.
England probably do.
New Zealand, South Africa would also be a cracking final. Let's not forget. Yes, it would.
No.
It was one of the games of the tournament so far in Yokohama.
Come on, it's just like another grim...
You had it, were you?
I was.
Yeah.
It's...
Did you feel watching it, though, that after a while South Africa almost accepted, do you know what, we won't get them today, but...
I think they burnt themselves out, to be honest.
We might see them later.
Yeah, maybe that was it. Maybe that was it. I thought their star performer last weekend was Faf de Klerk, and he was appalling against New Zealand. So that's one thing that they've managed to turn around. I think no matter what the combinations are here from the semi-finals, you've got a cracking World Cup final.
England and Wales, watching that as an Irishman would be sick, wouldn't we?
Well, no, it'd be sick for Ger Gilroy, who has an issue with both sets of supporters, particularly the Welsh supporters, let's not forget.
I mean, yeah, the Welsh supporters. I've literally no problem with the English supporters. That's... I mean, I said that I would prefer England to win rather than Wales.
Yeah, you did, to be fair.
Yeah.
It's more kind of a testament of your Welsh feelings rather than English feelings.
Yeah, I mean,
you met a few Welsh fans in Japan. They were very nice to you, actually.
We met some lovely Welsh fans.
Really nice people.
We also met some other Welsh fans.
And the Welsh fans, Phil, they came in and they were like, we love the Irish and you guys love us. And then Joe was just silent.
That's all right. Yeah.
Yeah, have you got anything else for us?
Yeah, well, obviously last night was all about the Champions League, Liverpool and Chelsea both winning. So they've 2 wins from 3 in their respective groups. Liverpool won 4-1 away to Genk. Chelsea 1-0 away to Ajax. Tonight, it's the Europa League. Manchester United, Arsenal, Wolves, Celtic and Rangers all in action. United can go top if they win away to Partizan Belgrade. Now, there is a lot of worry going into this game about racism, because Partizan have been ordered by UEFA to play 2 matches in the competition behind closed doors because of racist abuse from supporters. And I know it's something that Solskjaer mentioned in his press conference yesterday. They know the protocol's in place and, you know, pretty much said that they'd be prepared to walk off if there's an issue. Arsenal have a 100% record in Group F ahead of their match at home to Portuguese side Vitória. Wolves are away to Slovan Bratislava. Now, this game is due to be played behind closed doors again. Due to racism.
Ish. Behind closed doors, ish, right?
Yeah. So what they've did, the Slovakian club, they've taken advantage of a loophole. Article 73 of UEFA states, accompany children age 14 and under can attend a Bratislava, and Bratislava basically have exploited the loophole. 21,000 tickets they've given to kids for this game. The Wolves fans, 200 tickets.
Yeah.
And Bratislava actually said, we're sorry about that, but that's all you've got. And
going to be well-developed 14-year-old with beards.
Yeah, and then Celtic play Lazio. Now, this game is in Glasgow, but obviously next week's game is, or in 2 weeks' time, is in Rome, and that's going to be partially closed. Rangers are away to Porto. So Arsenal and Celtic games kick off at 8. The other three start at 5:55. And just some other news, Tiger Woods and Gary Woodland have a share of the lead on 6-under after day one of the Zozo Championship in Japan. Open champion Shane Lowry is 1-over. Rory McIlroy birdied his last to finish up on 2-over. Not a great day for Graham McDowell. He is well back on 11-over par.
All right, good stuff, Phil. Thanks very much for that. Now, it is Chai Line Breakfast Week all week this week, and the ISBCC Chai Line is calling on clubs, schools, colleges and communities across Ireland to keep Chai Line listening by hosting a breakfast this Chai Line Breakfast Week. Breakfast events are taking place right across the country to raise vital funds to ensure that children can always access support from Chai Line at any time that they need to. Any child or person up to the age of 18 in Ireland can contact Chai Line at any time to talk about any issue that might be on their mind. And I'm delighted to say that John Church, the Chief Executive of the ISBCC, joins us on OTBM this morning. John, good morning to you. How are you doing?
Morning, Chair. Very well, thank you.
So tell us a little bit about this. If anybody wants to have a breakfast and organise one, what do they need to do?
Very simple. If you just go on to the ispcc.ie, the front page there will have our banner about breakfast, and you just click to register. So it's very easy to register, and as soon as we receive it, you'll receive a pack as to what to do, together with some vouchers for Glenisk yogurt. And it's very simple. I mean, anybody can just organise it. We've been doing it for a number of years, and it's just really an important fundraising week for us to help keep Chai Line open 24/7.
Where does the funding go?
Well, it costs $3.5 million a year to run Chai Line. So, you know, we have call facilitators, we have supervisors, we have all the equipment that's needed, all the licensing on the software, the buildings, quite a bit of infrastructure behind Chai Line. So it keeps us going. We only get 10% of that funding from government. So it means we have to raise 90% of that $3.5 million every single year. So it's so important, all the funding that we get from the public. And that keeps us going 24/7.
How many calls a year are you getting, John?
Well, just to put it in context, I was arrived in this morning into the office about 8 o'clock, and we'd already received 1,200 in the last 24 hours. So we get between 1,000 and 1,200 calls a day. And then we have a new chat system, which is an online system that we introduced over a year ago because kids are not making phone calls anymore. And we get about 100 of those a day, and we hope to promote it. So we're 24/7 with the telephone, and we're online 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. every day. But we have plans to go 24/7 online as well. We just need to increase our funding to pay for that.
So that's the next stage, because obviously that's the frontier where most kids are on their phones but not actually using them to speak, and it's obviously
absolutely
much easier way.
Yeah. Absolutely, and like, it's a confidential listening service, so we're non-judgmental. And I think the online is really opening up yet a better avenue. Or when I say a better avenue, it's another avenue to contact a call facilitator within Chai Line. So, you know, when you're in your bedroom at night, or when you're at home, or in the privacy of anywhere in a club, you can go online to chat, and you won't be overheard. So I think it's going to be a fantastic service already without even promoting it. You know, we have 100 children a day contacting us online. So it's obviously a service that's needed.
And how many people do you have taking calls then?
See, we very much rely on volunteers. We've got about 150 volunteers in the Dublin area alone, and just over 200 volunteers operating around the country. So a typical shift would be about 4 hours, but quite a few volunteers give us an awful lot more time. The difficulty then we have is we have to have paid staff, say between 6 p.m. and then 8 p.m. or 8 a.m. the following morning. It's very difficult to get volunteers with those unsociable hours. So we would have a mixture of volunteers, which is the predominant service, and call facilitators that we pay. So we're constantly recruiting volunteers. It takes about 8 weeks to train them, and they're fully supervised. So they get a lot of satisfaction out of it. And, of course, we couldn't run the service without them.
Well, listen, best of luck with this week. It's obviously a hugely important week in terms of fundraising. And thanks very much for making the time to talk to us this morning.
Thank you.
It's John Church, the CEO of the ISBCC. And if you want to volunteer, or indeed if you want to get involved, check out ispcc.ie. You can host Childline Breakfast anytime up to the end of the week. If you want to get involved, you can still sign up at ispcc.ie. This week, we've been giving you the chance to win UEFA Champions League quarterfinal tickets. It's all thanks to Pepsi Max, one of the proud sponsors of the UEFA Champions League. We've had a daily winner each morning who will go into Friday's final, along with a chance of winning Champions League quarterfinal tickets. Every morning, you can win a Pepsi Max promotional pack. We asked you to send us your first Champions League memory, and the winner is Sean Martin. 1997 final, Dortmund. That was the Lars Ricken chip over Peruzzi. You guys were both remembering Lambert playing for Dortmund?
Lambert, yeah. Played midfield and obviously moved to Celtic, but it was just, it was a strange one back then seeing
somebody from Scotland.
From Scotland.
Who wasn't a former Celtic or Rangers player.
Yeah, yeah. So he went there and did well. I think of my first one, you mentioned that the Red Star Belgrade one that they brought the penalties, nil all. It's like the play for penalties. It was a horrible final.
Yeah. Was that 91?
Yeah, I think it was 91 because Sampdoria Barcelona was 92 at Wembley. I had a Sampdoria jersey. I was all in for Sampdoria. And then
was Vialli playing?
It would have been Vialli, Mancini.
Not a bad team.
Aluka was the keeper. Viekavod, the Lombardo.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
They had a good team.
What's yours on?
Zidane. It's Leverkusen.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. What? Probably a few Arsenal.
For Real Madrid.
Yeah.
2002.
What?
Yeah, like
not even you.
I don't remember Euro 2000, so it would have to be somewhere in between. Probably remember a few Arsenal group games, maybe just before that, but that's certainly the first real Champions League moment that I recall. What was the 0-1 Champions League final? Might stretch to 2000, 2001. If I don't remember Euro 2000, then I don't remember the Champions League final in 2000. So 2001 really is my last opportunity.
2001 Champions League final is Bayern Munich champions against Valencia.
3-0, wasn't it? No. I'm thinking of...
Is it a 1-1 they went on penalties?
Real Madrid beat Valencia 3-0. That was the one McManaman scored. That was 2000, isn't it?
I think so. Did Valencia win lose 3 in a row?
Definitely 2 in a row, yeah. Cooper's side, yeah.
Remember, if you don't win on OTBAM, there's loads more ways of winning Champions League tickets with Pepsi Max over at pepsimax.ie. Pepsi Max, maximum taste, no sugar. That's it from us this morning, is it? Nothing else?
It sure is. Thank you, Gilly. Are you taking it well or are you taking it badly? Or?
No, I mean, what are you going to do? Like, taking it well or taking it badly?
Like, I just don't think that there's been enough made of what has been one of the finest performances from an Irish comedian. Well, maybe there was great fanfare back here and I just didn't appreciate it. But, thank you.
All right. That's it from us this morning here on OTBM. Thank you so much for joining us. You can stay tuned to the Off The Ball channels and OTB Sports Radio throughout the day. If you missed anything from OTBM this morning, we had Kieran Donaghy and Mickey Quinn on talking about the rule changes, the structure and rule changes, rather, in GAA. We had Football with Graham Hunter with the sports pages. You can catch the podcast back on offtheball.com/podcast or indeed the Go Loud app. You can watch it back on our YouTube channel and subscribe there. Tonight on Off The Ball, John Giles, The Football Show and much more. Nathan, we'll see you tomorrow morning on OTB AM at 7:30. Adrian and Owen in studio. Good luck.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.